that is the grave of Santa Stwynwen, and she is our patron saint of lovers.
Join me, Martha Carney, for This Natural Life, Thursday afternoon at 3 on Radio 4, or listen to the series so far on BBC Sounds.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Monday, the 1st of December. This is Today with Nick Robinson and Anna Foster.
Good morning, the headlines today. A former high-ranking officer has told a public inquiry he believes two former heads of UK Special Forces suppressed evidence of war crimes by the SAS in Afghanistan. We'll be talking to a former SAS commander and a former Veterans Minister. Sir Keir Starmer will use a speech today to promise reform of the welfare state while defending his chancellor against allegations of misleading the public in the run-up to the budget.
Also in today's programme, descendants of the former US President John F. Kennedy and the former Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev unite for a new BBC programme on the Cuban Missile Crisis. We'll hear their story.
I was in this very dual relationship with history. On one hand, it was a family story, was a good decision for him to make at school. No, it was a very wrong thing to do.
And rage bait, aura farming and biohacking. Lexicographer Susie Dent will help us decipher the Oxford English Dictionary's words of the year. Before all of that, though, the BBC News is read for us this morning by Jane Steele.
Two former heads of UK Special Forces have been accused of suppressing evidence of war crimes. The claims were made at the public inquiry examining allegations of unlawful killings by the SAS in Afghanistan. A senior officer who can't be named told the hearings that the unit's leadership knew there was a problem but did nothing. Richard Bilton is from BBC Panorama, whose reports helped prompt the inquiry.
The officer who gave evidence without the public present was one of the most senior in UK Special Forces. He told the inquiry he was deeply troubled by what he strongly suspected was the unlawful killing of innocent people. He said two former heads of UK Special Forces knew of the allegations but failed to act. We contacted the men he named. One didn't respond. The other denied the accusations and said he would provide a comprehensive response in his evidence to the inquiry in due course. The MOD said the government was fully committed to supporting the independent inquiry, but would wait for the outcome before commenting further.
In the past hour, the Labour MP, Tulip Siddique, has been found guilty of corruption charges in absentia by a court in Bangladesh. The former Treasury Minister was convicted of using her power and influence over her aunt, Sheikh Hasina, the country's former Prime Minister, to obtain a plot of land in the capital, Dhaka. She's been sentenced to 2 years in prison and fined the equivalent of £620. Ms Siddique, who denied the charges, said the accusations were fabricated and politically motivated. Sir Keir Starmer will use a speech in London later today to defend his government's budget and commit to reforming the welfare state. He's also expected to back his Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, who has denied allegations that she misled the public about the state of the UK's finances in the build-up to the budget. The Conservatives have called for her to resign. Our political correspondent Joe Pike reports.
In his speech, the Prime Minister will say our welfare state is trapping people, not just in poverty, but out of work. Young people especially, and that is a poverty of ambition. But while Sir Keir wants to talk about welfare reform and economic growth, he is likely to face questions about whether his Chancellor has been honest. That is due to her interventions in the weeks building up to the budget. We now know that the economic forecasts she received in private were more upbeat than the impression left by her appearances in public. She told the BBC yesterday she did not accept she'd been misleading. But the Conservatives have written to the Financial Conduct Authority calling for an investigation. The Liberal Democrats want the Chancellor to be hauled before the Commons to explain herself, while Reform UK is calling on the government's ethics adviser to investigate.
President Trump's special envoy Steve Witkoff is expected to travel to Moscow today with the latest draft of a peace plan after talks in Florida between senior American and Ukrainian officials on ending the war with Russia. Mr. Trump said there was a good chance the US could make a deal, as our North America correspondent Sean Dilley reports.
The president struck a positive tone as he prepared to board Air Force One. He said he wanted to stop people being killed and he believed Russia wanted to see it ended too. The talks followed discussions last week in Geneva when Europeans and Ukrainians appeared to have modified an original 28-point American plan, which was widely seen as heavily favouring Russia. President Trump confirmed that his special envoy, Steve Witkoff, would travel to Moscow this week to continue talks with Russia. But with Kyiv having ruled out ceding more territory or limiting the size of its military, the future shape of any peace agreement with Russia remains unclear.
A major waste disposal firm has warned that vapes are still causing fires in rubbish lorries and waste facilities 6 months after the ban on disposables came into force. Suez says it's seen more than one fire a day in its network this year, causing millions of pounds of damage. The government says it is compulsory for all vape retailers to provide recycling bins. Ben King reports.
Suez handles household waste for more than 50 local authorities and runs over 300 sites around the UK. It says people are still treating reusable vapes as disposable, throwing away large numbers of the devices which contain lithium batteries. These can catch fire when crushed in the waste system. Suez called for a more ambitious plan to tackle cheap throwaway vapes, such as a nationwide recycling scheme paid for by producers.
The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, has announced measures aimed at stopping new HIV transmissions in England by the end of this decade. The plan includes more use of opt-out testing, where blood samples in emergency departments are automatically screened for the virus unless people say no. Mr. Streeting says that will help diagnose people who wouldn't normally get tested.
One of the great things about opt-out testing in emergency departments is not only does it enable us to screen more people and diagnose where people may not yet have a diagnosis, so we can treat them more quickly. It also normalises it. You know, being tested for HIV or hepatitis should be no different to any other type of test. It shouldn't come with any stigma.
The government is publishing its latest proposals to protect nature and restore the environment. The plan will include new measures to tackle fly tipping and reduce air pollution, as Jonah Fisher reports.
This revised environmental improvement plan will include what the government is calling an ambitious roadmap to clean up lakes and rivers, boost biodiversity, and protect and restore wildlife habitats. Much of it we'll have heard before, but it will also include new commitments to tackle so-called forever chemicals, which don't break down in the environment, and tougher penalties to try to crack down on fly tipping. Critics will wonder just how compatible these environmental goals are with the government's desire to boost economic growth and build more homes.
Jonah Fisher reporting.
Thank you, Jane. 7 minutes past six now. Let's see what the weather has in store for us on the first day of December. Simon King, morning.
Morning, Anna. Yes, and the first day of meteorological winter, and it starts off on a very wet note across the UK. We've got some heavy rain out there this morning and multiple warnings actually from the Met Office, including one more severe amber warning for South Wales today. We could see up to a month's worth of rain falling, and that is very likely to bring some extensive flooding to South Wales through today. But generally for South West England, Wales and North West England, it is going to be a very wet day. That rain is going to continue on and off, and particularly heavy, especially over the hills and the mountains of South Wales, where the amber warning is in force. The ground is already very saturated. There's some strong winds as well, especially around coastal areas, and temperatures of 11 to 14 degrees. For southeast England, the Midlands, northeast and eastern England, again, starting off with some rain, which is mostly light and patchy this morning, but it will turn heavier for a time, and especially so for parts of the South Pennines into the northwest Midlands. Again, there are some yellow warnings in force here. Some heavier showers later on drifting their way eastward. They could be gusty winds and thunderstorms mixed in with that. And again, some pretty strong winds, especially around southern coasts, temperatures of 11 to 13. For Northern Ireland, southwest Scotland, and eastern Scotland, rain will continue, I think, for much of the day, on and off, and again, particularly heavy with the risk of some flooding in southwestern Scotland. The rain turns a bit more showery into the afternoon, temperatures of 6 to 10 Celsius. And then for northern Scotland today, some rain this morning, that's going to gradually clear in, and there'll be some sunshine this afternoon, highs of 6 to 9 Celsius.
Simon, thank you very much indeed. It's 9 minutes past six. Let's take a first look at the papers. They're dominated by the row over whether the Chancellor was dishonest about the state of the public finances. Chancellor on the rack, says the front page of the Mail, whilst the Telegraph leads with Reform UK's call for her to face an ethics inquiry. Unnamed government ministers also pile on the pressure in the Times. One describes the handling of the budget as a disaster and tells the paper that at no point was the Cabinet told about the reality of the forecasts by the Office for Budget Responsibility. Another says that both Ms Reeves and the Prime Minister look weak and incompetent. According to the Financial Times, the pair have inextricably tied their political futures together. Keir can't afford to lose her, a Labour MP tells the paper. If she goes, he goes.
The I paper says that the Prime Minister will seek to shore up the under-fire Chancellor later today when he gives a speech, which will include what The Sun describes as a panicked pledge to slash welfare. Ahead of the address, Sir Keir writes in The Guardian that what he calls his big, bold, long-term plan will renew Britain. The paper describes his speech as an attempt to bolster his position and draw a line under the row. But the Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, writes in the Daily Express that if Ms Reeves had any decency, she would be gone by now.
The Sun leads with a revelations from what it calls underworld contacts, who say that criminals who once targeted banks and cash vans are now looking to the homes of Premier League footballers. The paper says the gangs scour social media for players who share photos of luxury goods before raiding their homes and selling the items to a Dublin-based group known as the Gucci Gang.
And the Daily Mirror this morning says that Nigel Farage filmed up to 2,000 videos for paying fans in the last 12 months, but spoke only 22 times in Parliament. The paper says he charges more than £70 for a personalised video on the website Cameo. A spokesman for the Reform UK leader says he's voted more times in the Commons than Sir Keir Starmer and Kemi Badenoch put together.
It is now 11 minutes past six.
The US Secretary of State Marco Rubio says that talks between American and Ukrainian negotiating teams in Florida to try and get closer to a peace deal have been productive, but more work is needed. James Waterhouse is our correspondent in Kyiv. James, take this apart for us, because people will inevitably hear that and think we've been here before, haven't we?
I think that's very fair, Anna. But I think from here, it feels like Ukraine's political page is turning. It has no choice but to stand there next to their American counterparts and say they want peace and say they are grateful to American efforts to bring this war to an end. They cannot risk the wrath of the Trump administration again and jeopardizing future military support. But I don't think that is as much of a risk as it has been. You heard Donald Trump acknowledge the problems Ukraine has been facing with a corruption scandal that isn't going away. And yet he also acknowledged that it is clear Ukraine wants peace and that he believed a deal could be signed soon. There is no doubt it's been a bruising week for Ukraine, with Zelensky losing his chief of staff and head negotiator, Andriy Yermak. You saw a new-looking delegation there, looking a little bit, I wouldn't say sheepish, but they weren't certainly comfortable at the start of the meeting. But clearly some warm words were exchanged, and it seems they talked about freezing the conflict as is and how de facto borders would be recognised. It is a thorny issue. But you have Valery Zaluzhny, a man widely tipped to succeed Zelensky here in Ukraine, breaking political cover, talking about how peace could provide a window for reform. And I think that does reflect Ukraine looking round the corner, planning for a pause in fighting, no matter how long that might be. And now all eyes are on what President Zelensky is doing this week. He's in Paris today meeting Emmanuel Macron, and Steve Witkoff, the US envoy, who was heard on a recording coaching the Russians on how to get on Donald Trump's good side, he will travel to Moscow in the midweek. And we are looking for any changes in the Ukrainian president's diary that suggests that a breakthrough might be sooner rather than later.
Yeah, we watch and we wait. Thank you, James. James Waterhouse, our correspondent in Kyiv.
13 minutes past six now. The Labour MP Tulip Sadiq has been found guilty of corruption charges in absentia by a court in the Bangladeshi capital, Dhaka. We're joined by a correspondent there, Arunadeh Mukherjee. Arunadeh, tell us what the court heard.
Well, essentially, this was a particular case where Tulip Siddiq had been co-accused, where she was accused and being tried for obtaining or using influence and power on the Sheikh Hasina administration, that is her aunt's administration, to get a piece of land allotted in a very lucrative area on the outskirts of Dhaka in a place called Purbachal. So this was one particular case where she's been found guilty and sentenced to 2 years in prison and imposed a fine of about 100,000 local currency, which is about a little over £600. This is that particular case where she was co-accused with her mother. But there are other cases as well where she's co-accused with her brother and sister as well. That verdict is still to come on a later date. So this is one particular strand of the investigation. It is also important to contextualize, as you would recall, this is part of a wider anti-corruption investigation by authorities here, which have been probing allegations against the former deposed Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina's regime and her family members, which is why Tulip Siddiq, the sitting Labour MP, was named in one of these cases.
And Aruna Day, it's pretty noisy there on the streets of Dhaka. What does this mean for Tulip Siddiq? They can't enforce this judgment on her, can they?
Well, that is the big question. Bangladesh and the UK do not have an extradition treaty. It is also important to reiterate that Tulip Siddiq, by way of her lawyers, has been very firm in rejecting any allegations of corruption. They have repeatedly maintained that this is part of a political witch hunt against her aunt, who was the former Prime Minister of Bangladesh, Sheikh Hasina. So they've rejected those allegations. They've even repeatedly mentioned that teams of the ACC, which is the Anti-Corruption Commission, when they had come to London, they made no attempts to meet her. They've not received any official legal correspondence or questioning when it comes to this. So repeatedly, they have questioned the credibility of this trial as well as investigation, and therefore it would be unlikely that she would serve this out. When it comes to the mood here on the streets in Dhaka, I think this is a part of the larger investigation, like I said, against Sheikh Hasina and her regime when she was in power. You would recall that 2 weeks ago, Sheikh Hasina herself was convicted and sentenced to life to the death penalty for crimes against humanity. So there is still a fair bit of anger against the Sheikh Hasina administration for the way in which she ran what they feel was an authoritarian regime. And in terms of impact politically, I think it would be interesting to see what happens in February when Bangladesh is looking at fresh elections.
Aruna Day Mukherjee there in Dhaka. It's lunchtime there, just after 12 o'clock, and quite noisy on the streets.
Yeah, you can hear it, can't you? 16 minutes past six now. Heathrow Airport's third runway has the green light, and the airport's own £49 billion plan has been selected to deliver it. But there are still questions about how to make sure one of the country's biggest infrastructure projects stays on budget and on time. Crucial details. Will Baines got more on that and the rest of the business news. Morning, Will.
Morning, Anna. Morning, Nick. Yeah, quick crucial question that we've heard with a lot of these projects over time as well, haven't we? Interesting then, though, that the aviation regulator, the CAA, has opened a process looking at how the airport operates and asking if an alternative model for capacity expansion could better serve the interests of consumers using the airport. It's something both the airlines and other businesses that operate at Heathrow have also welcomed. That is the process looking at this. Surinder Arora is one of those. He's the founder and chief executive of the Arora Group, Heathrow's biggest landowner, operator of many of its hotels, and had, you might remember, proposed an alternative third runway project that the government rejected last week. Surinder, morning.
Good morning to you.
Just on that, first of all, then, first time we've spoken to you since the decision last week. I guess disappointed, but are you willing to work with Heathrow on their plan now that it's the one that's picked?
Look, of course, anyone would be disappointed because the government had asked any parties to come forward with their alternative plans. I felt we came up with a plan which was more than credible and had the input from the airlines. At the end of the day, the airlines are the ones who are the experts on what length of runway and position, etc., should be. So we thought we'd obviously put forward a very credible plan. At the end of the day, the government decided to go with the alternative Heathrow plan over the M25. And we welcome at least that the government has made a decision. So from that point of view, we welcome it and we'll obviously work ahead and toward the DCO, the planning consent for the alternative plan.
And in terms of what the Civil Aviation Authority is looking at, one of the areas, I know it's something you've talked about a lot, is this issue that if costs overrun, Heathrow itself is liable for 25% of the overspend, and the airlines and others who use the airport like you then then pick up the rest. Is that right? And is that something that, that you're hoping is looked at through this process?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we've been seeing for years, not just the Aurora Group, but also the airlines, the consumer groups, the passengers, everyone has been saying that the regulatory system at Heathrow is broken, because the way the system currently operates is the more they spend at the airport, the more we end up, obviously, we pay and they end up making more profit. So one of the things we've been saying, that the regulatory system is broken and something needs to happen to make sure that they can't be incentivized to spend more and make more. Even things like building over the M25, that the more they spend, the more they'll make. So from our perspective, we really welcome the CAA's paper out last week, their report, which said that they are going to revisit. They're going to look at the regulatory system.
Yeah.
Both the CAA and the ministers have now said, mentioned about terminal competition.
Yes, is that something you're interested in? I mean, this is something that happened at John F. Kennedy Airport in New York, isn't it? Where terminals can be run by different organisations, basically, not overarchingly by the airport itself, and can compete as a result to attract airlines to fly from their terminals, things like that. You've been someone who's been talked about being interested as doing that in the past. Are you still?
Absolutely. And I think that a competition is a good thing. It doesn't matter whether you build it or I build it. If you look at, there are different terminals around, not just the JFK, but other airports around the world, whether Far East or whether even look at places like India. If you look at Saudi Arabia, for example, one of the terminals is operated by Dublin Airport. So,
Does it always work, though? Could it not be a race to the bottom? I mean, anybody who's flown through JFK recently might question how good the service it is that they get there, for example, if everybody's trying to just do it at the cut all their costs everywhere else.
Not at all. I think, certainly, if you look at even Heathrow or Gatwick or other airports around the world or other cities, even hotels where you've got more than one hotel, different brands, different properties.
Mm.
We should all welcome competition. That it's a good thing, and that way at least there is a benchmark. At the moment, if you're flying out of Heathrow or Gatwick, you haven't got a benchmark. You can't compare Heathrow to anyone else.
A quick thought on the budget as well, Surinder. Two thoughts. We know the Prime Minister today is going to talk about infrastructure more broadly in this speech that he's going to give a little bit later on today. We'd love your thoughts on where they could go further and faster, but also around tax and the tax system, full stop. You're a billionaire. You're one of our wealthiest entrepreneurs. We've heard a lot of talk in the papers of entrepreneurs of your kind of ilk leaving the country. Is it something you've considered?
We did, very openly, and I think we came out a few weeks ago and said, as a family, as a business, God's been kind to us. I've managed to make my success in this great country. I don't agree with all the policies. I don't think many people do, but I'd rather be here and end up paying our taxes. But I'm always hopeful, silver lining on the other side, that one day someone will look at this and say, actually, some of those policies need to be revisited. And so we decided, but we have lost lots of people, and these people would have been contributing to the, to our nation. I've always said that I think the one thing we should do in our great nation is actually we should celebrate success. We should encourage entrepreneurship. Whether it's anyone out there, if they're willing to work 18 hours a day or 20 hours a day or do the, whatever they want to achieve or send their kids to private school, at least we should have options. And I very much hope that in the long term that we might see celebrating success rather than being envious of others.
Surinder Arora, founder and chief executive of the Aurora Group, thanks so much for your time. Well, Shanti Kellerman is also with us this morning. Shanti, the co-chief investment officer at Seven Investment Management. Morning, Shanti. And to the budget point, Shanti, as well, two of our big companies, supermarket chain Asda, Premier Inn owner Whitbread, both warning about the impacts of this budget now as well.
I think the biggest short-term impact is that we haven't seen borrowing costs change for UK bonds, and that means mortgages, business borrowing will stay the same or go down a little. A lot of the other measures are implemented very far in the future, so it's hard to know what the impact will be, how people will maneuver to potentially avoid them, and if they'll ever actually be implemented. You know, lots like the, you know, EV mileage charge, the council tax on properties need consultations just to figure out how to do it.
What about the arguments about what the Chancellor knew and when? From a purely economic and investment perspective, does that matter, do you think?
I don't think it matters from an investment perspective. You know, she couldn't have had a budget with, you know, 4 or 5 billion of headroom. It would have been too low. It's probably a political question, you know, all the stuff around what she knew and when, but you probably couldn't have just come out with that amount and not had a reaction from the gilt market.
Yeah. Shanti, thanks so much for your time this morning. Shanti Kellerman there, the co-chief investment officer at Seven Investment Management. Well, as we mentioned, in a speech later on this morning, the Prime Minister is set to back the Chancellor's budget and say the government will go further and faster on pro-growth measures. One way the Chancellor tried to do that in last week's budget was helping startups, expanding programmes like the Enterprise Investment Scheme and putting in place a 3-year stamp duty holiday for new listings in the UK Stock Exchange. Russ Shaw is the founder and Tech London Advocate, which works with startup and scale-up tech companies right across the UK. Russ, morning.
Good morning.
So from what you've heard so far then, what's good news for members?
Well, you know, I think the measures announced by the Chancellor last week will certainly provide support to entrepreneurs and scaling businesses to ensure that the UK continues to create and build high-growth companies. And just for a bit of context, there are about 45,000 scaling companies across the UK. They have a collective turnover of about £2 trillion, and they employ about 4 million workers. So, and many of these companies are digital and tech companies, which have positioned the UK as the third largest tech ecosystem in the world after the US and China. So I think the measures are going to address some of the funding and talent challenges which high growth companies face, and they're going to hopefully remove some of the friction they experience as they grow at scale.
Is pace key here, the pace with which some of these measures come in? Heard from some in the industry that they're worried, you know, oh yeah, it sounds like a good idea, but if it's not going to be up and running for 3, 4, 5 years, industries like tech move so much faster than that.
Absolutely. The need for speed is absolutely critical here. And I do think, I believe a number of these measures will be implemented relatively quickly. We need much more scaling capital to go behind these scale-ups. And in addition to the budget, the Chancellor has been working on a number of provisions around pension funds to get them to invest more of their capital into scaling businesses. And I think the other thing that we're hoping to see more of is around training and skilling the British workforce on digital and AI skills. The Prime Minister announced an initiative a few months ago called Tech First, targeting 7.5 million adults to be trained on AI by 2030. So the clock is ticking, and I do travel to other tech hubs around the world, the US, China, many other places, India, they're all moving very quickly
and
in this space.
Where should we be moving faster then?
Well, I think in terms of training the workforce, absolutely vital. We have to keep improving the productivity numbers. That needs to be a priority. And I hope the Prime Minister will address some of that later today. And let's move faster on getting deeper pools of what we call scaling capital through the pension funds. The British Business Bank is very much working on this, but we need to make sure that deeper pools of funding are available for British scaling businesses. The measures last week are certainly going to help, but we need to keep driving on that agenda.
Russ Shaw, founder of Tech London Advocates, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Will. 27 minutes past six now. Carthy's here with the sport. Morning.
Morning. Thank you very much. Arsenal are 5 points clear at the top of the Premier League after a 1-1 draw with Chelsea, who went down to 10 men in the first half, but they did hold on for that draw. Liverpool had only their second win in 8 league games, a 2-0 victory over West Ham, with Alexander Isak scoring his first Premier League goal for Liverpool since his record £125 million move from Newcastle United. There were emotional scenes at the London Stadium with tributes paid to Billy Bonds, former West Ham captain and manager, who's died at the age of 79. The BBC's football correspondent John Murray looks back at his life.
For football fans of a certain age, think Billy Bonds and you think West Ham. 6'2", eyes of blue, Billy Bonds is after you, they used to sing about him. He was one of their favourites and one of the club's greatest servants. Indeed, he holds the record for the most appearances for the club, 799. And Billy Bonds served West Ham for 27 years as a player or coach or as manager. An uncompromising central defender, he actually never played for England, but was one of the best of his generation not to. But he'll always be part of the fabric at West Ham, where one of the stands is already named after him.
Well, in the day's other games, there were wins for Manchester United, Aston Villa and Brighton, while Martin O'Neill now has 6 wins in 7 games as interim manager of Celtic after they beat Hibs 2-1, and they are just 2 points off Hearts, who are top of the table. McLaren's Lando Norris missed the chance to take the Formula One world title in Qatar yesterday, finishing in 4th place. Red Bull's Max Verstappen won the Qatar Grand Prix, as Harry Benjamin reports.
Another twist in this 2025 World Championship under the lights in Qatar. Both McLarens losing out to Max Verstappen after they opted for an alternative strategy which didn't pay off. Verstappen practically cruised to the end with Piastri trying to mount a comeback, ultimately to no avail. Lando Norris found himself off the podium but picked up 4th right at the very end to give himself a 12-point buffer over Max Verstappen, who now sits 2nd with Oscar Piastri 3rd in the championship. The title will be decided then at the final race of the year in Abu Dhabi next week with a 3-way showdown. If Norris finishes in the top 3, the title is his.
And you may have heard Sir Ben Ainslie on the programme last week giving me a tour of the Sail GP factory where the F50 catamarans are built. Well, he and the Emirates GBR team have become the first British team to win the end of season grand final, winning the title yesterday in Abu Dhabi.
Carthy, thank you.
Make family time stress-free this Christmas with CBeebies Parenting. There's loads of things to do. Simple recipes to try together and activities to keep your little one learning as they play. Games with your favourite characters.
You can also use these buttons.
And, of course, all the shows you can watch together.
This is amazing.
Share some magic moments this Christmas. CBeebies Parenting, here when you need us. Search CBeebies Parenting.
It is just after 6:30 now. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson. And Jane Steele has a summary of the news for us.
2 former heads of UK Special Forces have been accused of suppressing evidence of war crimes. The claims were made at the public inquiry examining allegations of unlawful killings by the SAS in Afghanistan. A senior officer who can't be named told the hearings that the leadership of the Special Forces knew there was a problem but did nothing. The Labour MP, Tulip Siddiq, has been found guilty of corruption charges in Bangladesh and sentenced to 2 years in prison. The former Treasury Minister was convicted in her absence of using her influence over her aunt, Sheikh Hasina, the country's former Prime Minister, to obtain a plot of land in the capital, Dhaka. Ms. Siddiq denies the charges, saying they are fabricated and politically motivated. The Prime Minister is expected to make a speech in London this morning in which he will defend his budget and back his Chancellor, Rachel Reeves. She has denied claims that she misled the public about the state of the UK's finances by making it appear worse than the economic forecast she'd received. The Conservatives have written to the Financial Conduct Authority requesting an investigation and also called for Ms. Reeves' resignation. President Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, is expected to travel to Moscow today to discuss the latest draft of a peace plan after talks in Florida between senior American and Ukrainian officials on ending the war with Russia. Meanwhile, the Ukrainian leader, Volodymyr Zelensky, is due to meet President Emmanuel Macron in Paris today. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, has announced measures aimed at stopping new HIV transmissions in England by the end of this decade. They include more use of opt-out testing, where blood samples in emergency departments are automatically screened for the virus unless people say no. The government says tackling stigma will help people to come forward who wouldn't normally get tested. South East Water says it expects to restore supplies throughout the morning to about 23,000 customers in Kent. It has apologised and has also been handing out free bottled water in Tunbridge Wells after a problem at a treatment works yesterday caused the supply issues.
Thank you, Jane. It is 27 minutes to 7 now. As you were hearing, 2 former heads of UK Special Forces have been accused of suppressing evidence of war crimes. The claims were made at the public inquiry, which is examining allegations of unlawful killing by the SAS in Afghanistan. A senior officer, who can't be identified, told the hearings that the leadership of the Special Forces knew there was a problem but did nothing. Well, Panorama's Richard Bilton has been looking into this. Richard, good morning. Tell us, first of all, just remind us of the background to all of this.
Yeah, now this is about events that happened in Helmand in Afghanistan in the period between 2010
and 2014. British forces were then part of the coalition fighting the Taliban. Now, UK special forces were sent on so-called kill or capture operations that happened mainly at night. BBC Panorama has been investigating these raids for more than 7 years. Now, we have previously reported that 54 detainees, including unarmed men and boys, were killed by the SAS in suspicious circumstances during 1 6-month tour in Afghanistan in the winter of 2010. The reports led to the setting up of this public inquiry.
And who gave evidence and what did he say?
Well, the officer who gave evidence in closed session without the public present was one of the most senior in special forces. We can't name him due to restrictions on reporting. He told the inquiry that he became concerned by a number of issues, really. One was the number of deaths compared to weapons claimed to have been recovered. More deaths than weapons claimed to have actually been recovered. That was something that he said was commonplace. He was also concerned about the number of times detainees were taken back inside buildings only, and this is his quote, only for them to end up dead. He also told the inquiry he'd been made aware of whistleblower testimony that SAS troopers had been heard bragging during a training course about killing all fighting age males during operations, kind of regardless of whether they posed a threat or not. So he said to the inquiry, I was deeply troubled by what I strongly suspected was the unlawful killing of innocent people, including children. Now, the officer said he'd been so concerned by SAS behaviour in Afghanistan, he commissioned a review, and in his words, the results were startlingly bad and indicated war crimes. He told the inquiry two former heads of UK special forces knew the allegations but failed to report them to the military police. He said that, in effect, they suppressed the allegations.
And what has the response to this been, Richard?
Well, under the rules of the inquiry, we're not allowed to name the two men in relation to the inquiry proceedings. We contacted both of the former heads of UK Special Forces. One didn't respond. The other told us that he refuted the allegations, that he would provide a comprehensive response to each of these matters in his evidence to the inquiry in due course. He also said that none of his senior commanders expressed any concerns or produced any evidence of unlawful killings at any stage of his 3 years in charge, and that there was no allegations or evidence he was aware of to refer to the Royal Military Police. And the Ministry of Defence, they said the government was fully committed to supporting the independent inquiry, but they added they would wait for the outcome before they commented further.
Richard Bilton, Panorama reporter, thank you. We'll hear later in the programme from a former SAS commander and from a former Veterans Minister on this story as well.
It's now 24 minutes to 7. I didn't mislead, I didn't lie about the state of the public finances, the Chancellor insists, but her opponents are still demanding an inquiry. Henry Zeffman is our chief political correspondent and joins us on the line. Morning to you, Henry. There'd be people listening to this programme who routinely assume that they are at least partially misled by what politicians say, but this row has taken on a bigger dimension than many of the rows about that sort of thing. Why so?
Yeah, I think that's right, Nick. And let's just start with the obvious. That is not the question that the government would like to be asked about its budget 5 days on from a budget, and gives you a measure, I think, of how things have deteriorated since Wednesday for Rachel Reeves. Why is this different? Why does this matter? I think there's various reasons. One is that people are being asked, to use Rachel Reeves's verb, to pay more tax. So the basis on which they're being asked to do so does really matter. Another is that the government has, and it acknowledges this, departed in tax policy from the language that it was using in the run-up to the general election. And they say that is because the economic inheritance was even worse than they appreciated it would be, and because the world has changed in the past year or so. But obviously the basis on which people are being asked to pay more tax than they expected from this Labour government really matters. Another reason is that Rachel Reeves gave that Downing Street address, commandeering the airwaves early in the morning on the 4th of November. So the arguments that she made to the general public on breakfast television and radio then really matter. I think it also matters because honesty and integrity were at the heart of this Labour Party's pitch for office. And so questions about the honesty and integrity of the Chancellor and the Prime Minister are therefore paramount. But I think I should stress this from my reporting. MPs I spoke to on Wednesday and Thursday were broadly positive about the budget and the choices that Rachel Reeves had made. And largely over the weekend, that appeared to remain the case. Many of them, on all wings of the Labour Party, especially delighted with the decision to abolish the two-child benefit cap, which they believe will alleviate child poverty for so many. Now, it may well be that these rows mean that that reaction among the parliamentary Labour Party, sensitive as they are to public opinion, begins to curdle. But I don't think that's quite happening yet.
The Prime Minister is clearly a little bit nervous, though. He's giving a big speech on the economy today and emphasising that having been criticised for producing a budget that funds benefits Street by some critics, he is in fact committed to reforming welfare.
Yeah, that's right. Prime Minister's speech today will emphasise growth, something that wasn't so much a feature of the budget speech, and welfare, something which, or welfare reform, wasn't particularly a feature of the budget either. He will say our welfare state is trapping people, not just in poverty, but out of work, young people especially, and that is a poverty of ambition. Now, the direction of travel has been very different on welfare in the Prime Minister's year and a half or so in office compared to what he wanted. He's reversed course on winter fuel, on disability benefits, and then, of course, lifted the two-child benefit cap after having resisted doing so, at least initially. What is important to say, though, is that I don't think anything is imminent on welfare reforms. The next budget is about a year away. The last one was less than a week ago. But the direction of travel here is that the government wants to focus more when it comes back for more welfare reforms, specifically this time on the younger people claiming health-related benefits and measures to try to get more of them into work.
Henry, thank you.
It's 20-7. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has asked the country's president to pardon him to try to bring his long-running corruption trial to a premature end. Yolande Nell is our Middle East correspondent. Yolande, I think to fully understand this, we have to go backwards before we look at the here and now. What is it, remind us, that he was charged with?
So, I mean, he is the only sitting prime minister in Israel's history to stand trial. He's basically charged with fraud, breach of trust, accepting bribes. There are these three separate cases, but in all of them, the basic accusation is that he exchanged favours with wealthy political supporters. So in one case, a telecoms company, a Hollywood producer, a newspaper publisher. He has always rejected these allegations. He's described the case as being a witch hunt orchestrated by the media, by the police, the judiciary, kind of the deep state. He's not been convicted of anything, but this has now cast a long shadow over Israeli politics for years. And, you know, remember recently during the war in Gaza, some parents of hostages were accusing Benjamin Netanyahu of drawing out the war as part of his efforts to stay in office. Prior to the war, Israel just saw years of political crisis and gridlock, 5 elections in 4 years, with the country basically split over this key issue, whether Benjamin Netanyahu was fit to run the country while fighting these corruption charges.
And now the president, Isaac Herzog, has got a difficult decision to make. He needs to decide whether or not to pardon him, knowing that whatever the result is, it will please some people and it will displease others. What is the process for that?
So the president's office has made clear it's going to take many weeks for them to make a decision. They've outlined that this is an extraordinary request. It has significant implications. This request now goes off to the Justice Ministry for opinions. It then comes back to the legal advisor at the president's office to formulate kind of legal opinions on all this. And experts, you know, you can imagine picking over this in the Israeli media this morning. They're saying the president does have this broad discretion to grant a pardon. Oversight is pretty limited. But, you know, it is extremely unusual to have a request for a pardon before all legal proceedings have ended. This possibility of a pre-conviction pardon. And, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu's grounds for this are saying about ending the social division, bringing about reconciliation. He said a pardon would actually go against his personal interest in proving his innocence, but that the public interest should prevail here. And so, you know, once again, you've got the divisions opening up in Israel, where you've got a small protest outside the president's home. It was a big pile of bananas there last night with a sign saying a pardon equals a banana republic. Opposition figures looking ahead to the elections next year, saying that acceptance of any kind of, you know, request from the prime minister should be conditioned on him retiring from politics, and also, you know, having a confession of wrongdoing, an expression of remorse is what Lapid, one opposition figure, calls for. But there are Israelis and there are allies of the prime minister who say this issue's just hijacked politics for too long. They want to move on from it.
Yolande Nell, thank you.
Let's take a quick look at the papers at 17 minutes to 7. It isn't that often that you see the word lie on the front pages, but that word is all over them. The Eye paper, I didn't lie about budget tax rises and black hole, insists Reeves. The Mail, Farage, Reeves must face sleaze probe over budget lies. The Telegraph, Reeves faces ethics probe over budget lies. The Times moves the story on by quoting a minister that it's spoken to, anonymously, of course, saying that they felt misled. So misled is the word that they use on their front pages. It's only The Guardian, actually, that's reporting on the politics that has the sort of headline that the Labour Party would want to have, and certainly Keir Starmer would want to have. PM says bold plan will take years to deliver as he hits back at critics. He's written an article for the paper talking, yes, about welfare reform, as we were just hearing from Henry, but also, interestingly, about a hint, at least, of a renegotiation of our relationship with Europe, because he says we must confront the reality the botched Brexit deal significantly hurt our economy.
The front of the FT this morning says that NATO chiefs are weighing a more aggressive response to Russian hybrid warfare. This is the alliance's most senior military officer speaking to the newspaper, saying that in response to things like Russian cyber attacks, sabotage, airspace violations, which we've seen growing in the last few months, Admiral Giuseppe Cavo Dragoni says that actually it should be a more proactive, a more aggressive response rather than, as he describes it, on cyber at the moment. We're kind of reactive are the words that he used. And also, if you're a parent, and particularly with Christmas coming, the front page of the Times this morning talks about it raising, it costs nowadays £250,000 to raise a child. The most expensive period, it says, is between 15 and 18 years old due to personal grooming costs.
Personal grooming?
Which if you have a teen of that sort of age, right, will be no surprise to you at all. I'm sure it's the hair gel, it's the skincare, yeah, it's, you know, all that sort
a
of
bargain
thing.
For £250,000, really, just to it look is good. Mm. It is 7:15 now. Fear of being judged and discriminated against means that many gay men do not get tested for HIV. Even though with the right treatment they can live long, healthy lives, a new government action plan aims to tackle that problem. Someone who's been involved in drafting that up is the chief executive of Terence Higgins Trust, Richard Angel, who joins us on the line. Morning to you, Richard. Let's begin with the problem. What is the problem you're trying to deal with?
There's about 5,000 people across the UK who are living with HIV but don't know it. They desperately need a test and make sure they get the world-class treatment that will mean they have a normal life expectancy. There's also about between 8 and 12,000 people who are living with HIV and know about it, but stigma, shame, discrimination and often poverty in their lives stops them taking their medication. And so they are hurtling towards being very unwell, and we need a programme to find those. What this plan does today is addresses both of those key issues and really moves us on in our ability to end new cases and do it by 2030. We have all the tools, and we could be the first country in the world to end this epidemic. Well, let's today begin, is a real boost to that. Mm-hmm.
Begin with the first of the things that you identify. Part of what the plan involves, as I understand it, is to automatically test people who turn up for healthcare, test their blood in order to check whether they have got this, have got HIV.
Absolutely. And it's been a remarkable programme. It started under the Conservative government, invested in 16 hospitals. And last year, Keir Starmer announced it had been expanded to 90 hospitals. What Wes Streeting has done today is confirm that that will happen for 3 more years. It will happen not only for HIV, but for hepatitis B and C. It's a remarkable thing. We've done 3 million tests so far in an A&E setting. We've diagnosed 7,000 people with a bloodborne virus, 1,400 with HIV. For context, in 2019, the year before COVID, 100,000 tests were done in A&E and almost nobody was diagnosed. This is an absolute transformation, and it is so great to see this becoming business as usual in the NHS.
But for people who have got the virus but aren't getting the treatment, what can you do about them?
Those people need us to reach out to them and help them with the issues in their lives that seem more important than taking their medication. And today Wes Streeting's announcing £9 million over 3 years for the charity sector to go out and find those people. It's too expensive to use a nurse or a doctor to find those people, but the charity sector has people who are passionate, committed, skilled, and able to reach out and find those people on their own terms. They might need a hardship grant. They might need some counselling. They might need support with housing needs. if we can help them with the issues in their lives, we can help them take their medication and be in charge of the virus, their own health. And when you take your medication living with HIV, not only will you be well, you can have sex without a condom and you can't pass it on. We know that from 58,000 acts of condomless sex. It's, you can say it clear. It's a fact that if you take your medication, you can't pass it on. So we've got to get those people their medication.
Richard Angel of the Terence Higgins Trust. Thanks for joining us.
It's 12 minutes to 7. More than 20,000 people in part of Kent have been without water this weekend because of a problem at the local treatment works. South East Water has set up several distribution stations in Tunbridge Wells. They hope they can get things back to normal this morning, but there is real unhappiness locally. People living there say that they have not been properly looked after while this has been happening. Mike Martin is the Lib Dem MP for Tunbridge Wells. Good morning.
Good morning, Anna.
What's been going on here? What have people been telling you?
I mean, it's been an absolute disaster. Bits of town lost water on Saturday. Pretty much the whole town, this is a town of 50,000 people, lost water on Sunday. It took a long time for the first site, water distribution site in Tunbridge Wells to be set up. And there were not enough deliveries to that, so it had to close. Traffic was snarled up. There's been extremely poor communication throughout from South East Water. If you have a look at their website now, they'll tell you that the situation is going to be resolved at 6 a.m, yet there's no water. And today we find that all of the schools are having to close because we don't know what's happening, and the water's still not back on.
So the communication is not right. And you said that this happens, well, it's happened before.
So about 3 years ago, the water went off for 6 days. And again, the crisis management and the communications were absolutely appalling then. And the chief executive officer said, you know, a number of lessons have been learned, the usual kind of platitudes, particularly about crisis management, resilience, communication, all of the things that we've seen a total failure of over the last few days. And people are utterly, utterly furious.
Okay, well, let's put that, thank you, Mike Martin, the Lib Dem MP for Tunbridge Wells. Let's put that to Tanya Sefton, who's the Customer Services Director for South East Water. Good morning.
Good morning.
It sounds like you've really let people down here.
Well, first of all, I'd like to apologise to all the customers in the area of Tunbridge Wells that have been impacted over the last 48 hours. They have been impacted before. We know it's a difficult situation when they have no water. It isn't the service we're aiming to provide. But we are doing everything to restore supplies, which I'm pleased to say they are starting to return this morning. We've had the first 500 customers come back into supply since 5 o'clock. We had an issue at our treatment works due to water quality concern. Because of the parameters on the site, we had to shut down the site to ensure that we didn't provide customers with water that wasn't fit for consumption. So it wasn't operational, which meant that we did lose a large area of customers Sunday, yeah. Over
things,
Saturday night.
Things do go wrong. Things do go wrong. But it's incumbent on you to have a really robust plan in place that you can help people when they do go wrong. And you clearly haven't.
Well, that's absolutely right. We do need to. We do have a plan in place. Our first priority is to ensure that the local hospital's emergency plan was mobilised, and that was done on Saturday afternoon. All of our customers who have signed up to our priority services register as unable to collect water started to receive deliveries on Saturday. We've made over 4,000 deliveries of bottled water to those customers over the last sort of since Saturday afternoon. And we mobilised bottled water stations, as Mike mentioned.
Well, he mentioned that it didn't go very well. So how are you going to make sure that doesn't happen for people again in the future?
It's always a challenge to get the right location for people for a bottled water station. I'd like to thank Mike for his support in providing some options for us yesterday morning to ensure they were in the right locations. We've given out over 113,000 bottles of water across those three sites. And they'll remain open until all supplies have returned later today.
And lessons to be learned on your part?
Of course, there's always lessons to be learned from all of our events, and learnings will be taken forward.
Tanya Sefton, the Customer Services Director for South East Water, thank you.
It is now 7 minutes to seven. The party meant to be a challenger to Labour on its left has been bored, but your party, as it is now officially known, had a leadership split on the first day of its inaugural conference with one of its founding leaders, the former Labour MP Zara Sultana, boycotting the conference, whilst the other, former Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn, said, without apparent irony, that his new party was determined to unite people.
It's up to us to develop a mass party and a force that does bring people in and give people that sense of hope. That is why we're here, and that's what we're determined to do.
Listening to that, Councillor James Giles. Well, he's listening to it because he wasn't able to listen to it at the conference because he was barred from going in. He is an ally of Zara Sultana. Morning to you, Councillor Giles. Why were you barred then?
Well, unfortunately, it was a bit of a bumpy road, I think it's fair to say, in all of this, both at conference and indeed the months leading up to it. And, you know, I think it's fair to say there's been a little bit of factionalism going on. You know, on the eve of conference, we saw, without members taking a vote, the current interim leadership excluding SWP members. Now, I'm not and never have been a member of the SWP.
It's the Socialist Workers' Party, for people who don't follow these things.
Forgive me, yes, indeed. Yeah. And then, indeed, the morning of conference, both myself and another councillor who is pro-Zara, Councillor Michael Lavalette in Preston, finding out that we wouldn't be allowed into the conference either on completely spurious grounds.
Well, when you say it's factionalism, what are you actually arguing about?
Well, I'm afraid it's to some degree, it's personalities over policies. But what I would say is, you know, by the end of conference, you know, Michael was officially allowed in, and by hook or by crook, I was in the hall too. Mm. And, you know, listening to Zara's speech and Jeremy's, you know, it's clear now, I think, with the members' votes, that the show can now get on the road because the members have voted quite decisively.
Well, really? I mean, Jeremy Corbyn was surrounded by someone accusing him of not being anti-Israel enough. Do you think Jeremy Corbyn is too pro-Israel? Is that the problem with him?
No, I think that's ridiculous, and I think there's a few...
Well, it was one of your supporters, one of Zara Sultana's supporters, who accused him of just that.
No, I think there's a small number of people, and I know the people you're referring to, who are making that claim, and they've been making that claim for months. I thought it was ridiculous when they first made the claim. I still think it's ridiculous.
Oh, they're another faction, are they? There's a Corbyn faction, a Sultana faction, and then another faction.
Well, no, I'm afraid they're members of the Revolutionary Communist Group.
Sorry, not the SWP, not that. Have you seen Life of Brian, Councillor Giles?
Yes, I have, Nick.
You've seen that scene where the People's Popular Front of Judea fight with the Popular Front of Judea? I mean, it's kind of funny, but it seems to be quite a good description of real life in your party.
Well, it's a phrase I've heard from journalists a number of times this weekend, but what we can't escape the fact is that the members actually did make some decisive votes this weekend and actually, you know, did vote, if I can use the phrase, if you like, to take back control. They've decided that members are going to shape a collective leadership at least until 2027.
What does that mean? What is a collective leadership?
Well, it means that there'll be a committee made up of 20 ordinary members, of whom there'll be a chair who will be de facto leader.
There's going to be 20 chair. Leaders of your party.
Well, it works similar to the way principal speakers worked in the Green Party up until about 2008. For the
I think there were only two of them, not 20, were there?
Well, no, there was a goodly number at times. Oh, okay. So maybe not as many as 20, but certainly more than two.
Well, it's hard to see what can go wrong, Councillor Giles. It sounds like it's going swimmingly.
No, I think that members, you know, gave a decisive vote. You know, there isn't a handbook for building a party. But what I think I can say, coming out of conference with some confidence, is that, you know, it's been a bumpy road. You know, I don't think we've necessarily covered ourselves in glory, but we do now have a firm basis on which we can start building something that will eventually be able to take the fight to Reform and Labour.
Councillor Giles, thank you for joining us.
It's 7:03. Tomorrow morning on Radio 4.
Most of us want to be seen and admired.
The 2025 Wreath Lectures continue.
But in our society, today, we admire the wrong things and the wrong people.
The historian Rutger Bregman delivers the second of his lectures on moral revolution.
What the British abolitionist taught me is that it is possible to rewrite a nation's honour code.
Considering how small groups of committed people can change the world for the better.
Our goal should be to make future historians proud. the 2025 Reef Lectures
on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds continues tomorrow morning at 9.
It's time to check the weather. Here's Simon King.
Anna, it's a very wet start today across many parts of the UK, and this rain is likely to cause some flooding, particularly around western areas of the UK, and especially so in South Wales, where there's an amber warning from the Met Office. A reminder, that's the second highest level of warning. Flooding is very, very likely across South Wales. So already for South West England, Wales, North West England, we've had a lot of rainfall overnight. That is just going to continue all day today. It'll be especially heavy over the higher ground. We could see up to a month's worth of rain falling actually in some parts. That will lead on to the flooding as rainfall totals build up as the day goes on. Maximum temperatures getting up to about 11 to 14 degrees. Also, she mentioned some strong winds around coastal areas, gusts up to 60 miles an hour. For southeast England, the Midlands, northeast and eastern England, the rain is quite light and quite patchy at the moment, but there'll be some heavier rain for a time in parts of the Pennines, the North West Midlands, where there are yellow warnings in force. And the rain is likely to continue on and off pretty much all day. If anything, a band of heavier and gusty showers with some thunderstorms will move their way in across the Midlands, eastern and southeast England later this afternoon. Again, some strong winds, especially around coastal areas, highs of 11 to 13. For Northern Ireland, southwest and eastern Scotland, some rain on and off continuing through today. Could be particularly heavy in southwestern Scotland today. Risk of some localised flooding here. Temperatures of 6 to 10. But for northern Scotland, some sunshine certainly through the afternoon.
Thank you, Simon. You're listening to Today. Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Monday, the 1st of December. Nick Robinson and Anna Foster with you this morning. The headlines today, the public inquiry into allegations of unlawful killing by the SAS in Afghanistan has been told that two former heads of UK special forces suppressed evidence of war crimes. We'll get the view of a former SAS commander after the news. A court in Bangladesh has convicted the Labour MP, Tulip Sadiq, of corruption charges in her absence. And the Prime Minister is mounting a defence of last week's budget after the Chancellor was forced to deny misleading the public about the state of the nation's finances. Also in the next hour... Will passengers for the 7 o'clock Avanti West Coast service from Manchester to London Euston please not board the train now? We'll find out why that service is soon going to be running without any paying customers on it. And rage baiting, aura farming, biohacking, lexicographer Susie Dent will help us decipher the Oxford English Dictionary's words of the year. Before that, the BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
Two former heads of UK special forces have been accused of suppressing evidence of war crimes. The claims were made at the public inquiry examining allegations of unlawful killings by the SAS in Afghanistan. A senior officer, who can't be named, told the hearings that the leadership of the special forces knew there was a problem, but did nothing. Richard Bilton is from the BBC's Panorama programme, whose report helped prompt the inquiry.
This is significant testimony. The officer, who gave evidence in closed session without the public present, was one of the most senior in UK Special Forces. He told the inquiry he was deeply troubled by what he strongly suspected was the unlawful killing of innocent people, including children. He said two former heads of UK Special Forces knew of the allegations of war crimes but failed to act. We contacted the men he named. One didn't respond. The other denied the accusations and said he would provide a comprehensive response in his evidence to the inquiry in due course. A Ministry of Defence spokesperson said the government was fully committed to supporting the independent inquiry, but added they would wait for the outcome before commenting further.
The Labour MP, Tulip Sadiq, has been found guilty of corruption charges in Bangladesh and sentenced to 2 years in prison. She was tried in her absence by a court in the capital, Dhaka. Ms. Sadiq denied the charges, which she called fabricated. Arunadeh Mukherjee reports from outside the court in Dhaka.
Tulip Sadiq was convicted of using her power and influence over her aunt Sheikh Hasina, the former Prime Minister of Bangladesh, to obtain a plot of land for her mother on the outskirts of Dhaka. Ms. Sadiq, a former Treasury Minister, is being investigated by Bangladesh's Anti-Corruption Commission as part of a wider probe into her aunt's regime. Ms. Hasina was deposed last year during anti-government protests. The judge also fined Ms. Sadiq 100,000 Bangladeshi taka, which is roughly a little over £600, and warned that if she fails to pay, 6 more months will be added to her sentence. The UK and Bangladesh have no formal extradition treaty. Mr. Sadiq's lawyers have denied the allegations and dismissed the trial as politically motivated. Separately, Mr. Sadiq is also facing other accusations of embezzlement and using fake documents to transfer property, charges she has also rejected.
Sir Keir Starmer will use a speech in London later today to defend his government's budget and commit to reforming the welfare state. He's also expected to back his Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, who has denied allegations that she misled the public about the state of the UK's finances in the build-up to the budget. The Conservatives have called for her to resign. Our political correspondent Joe Pike reports.
In his speech, the Prime Minister will say our welfare state is trapping people, not just in poverty, but out of work. Young people especially, and that is a poverty of ambition. But while Sir Keir wants to talk about welfare reform and economic growth, he is likely to face questions about whether his Chancellor has been honest. That is due to her interventions in the weeks building up to the budget. We now know that the economic forecasts she received in private were more upbeat than the impression left by her appearances in public. She told the BBC yesterday she did not accept she'd been misleading. But the Conservatives have written to the Financial Conduct Authority calling for an investigation. They argue the Chancellor's pre-budget statements had an impact on the markets and on people's mortgages. The Liberal Democrats want the Chancellor to be hauled before the Commons to explain herself, while Reform UK is calling on the government's ethics adviser to investigate.
President Trump's special envoy Steve Witkoff is expected to travel to Moscow today with the latest draft of a peace plan after talks in Florida between senior American and Ukrainian officials on ending the war with Russia. Mr. Trump said there was a good chance the US could make a deal, as our North America correspondent Sean Dilley reports.
The president struck a positive tone as he prepared to board Air Force One. He said he wanted to stop people being killed and he believed Russia wanted to see it ended too. The talks followed discussions last week in Geneva when Europeans and Ukrainians appeared to have modified an original 28-point American plan, which was widely seen as heavily favouring Russia. Earlier, the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio described the talks as delicate and complicated, but he insisted officials were optimistic. The Ukrainian National Security Advisor Rustem Umerov again thanked the United States and its leadership. But with Kyiv having ruled out ceding more territory or limiting the size of its military, the future shape of any peace agreement with Russia remains unclear.
A major waste disposal firm has warned that vapes are still causing fires in rubbish lorries and waste facilities 6 months after the ban on disposables came into force. Suez says it has seen more than one fire a day in its network this year, causing millions of pounds of damage. The government says it is compulsory for all vape retailers to provide recycling bins. Ben King reports.
Suez handles household waste for more than 50 local authorities and runs over 300 sites around the UK. It says people are still treating reusable vapes as disposable, throwing away large numbers of the devices which contain lithium batteries. These can catch fire when crushed in the waste system. Suez called for a more ambitious plan to tackle cheap throwaway vapes, such as a nationwide recycling scheme paid for by producers. A body representing the vape industry said the number of devices sold had fallen by more than a half since the ban was introduced, but called for greater consumer education on how to dispose of them responsibly. Vapes should be put in specialised recycling bins, not general recycling or waste.
A BBC Eye investigation has found evidence that the authorities in Georgia used a chemical weapon dating from the First World War against anti-government protesters in the capital Tbilisi in November last year. Thousands joined demonstrations against the government's decision to delay moves towards joining the European Union. More than 100 protesters suffered long-term effects after being hit by chemicals in tear gas and water cannons. More details from James Kumarasamy.
A former member of Georgia's riot police told BBC Eye he'd been instructed in 2009 to test two chemical agents together for crowd control purposes. Lasha Shergelashvili described the mixture as 10 times stronger than regular tear gas. He said it burned his eyes, made it hard to breathe, and caused some of his colleagues to vomit. Although he left the force in 2022, Shergelashvili said colleagues who were still serving confirmed to him the same chemicals were used in water cannons last year. Another former senior officer also told us the substance was deployed against crowds in 2024. One leading toxicologist who reviewed the BBC's evidence said what they saw was consistent with one of the chemicals being camite, a chemical used as a weapon during the First World War. The Georgian government described the allegations as absurd and said the police acted within the law.
An amber weather warning for rain is in effect in South Wales until midnight, meaning there's likely to be disruption and flooding of homes and businesses. Up to 120 millimetres of rain is expected in places. Oxford University Press has named its word of the year. Ragebait refers to online content which is designed to make people angry so that they click on it. It beats two other terms, aura farming, which is cultivating a cool image, and biohack, a change to lifestyle, diet or body to improve health. Here's our culture reporter, Noor Nanji.
Do you find yourself getting increasingly irate while scrolling through your social media feed? If so, you may be falling victim to ragebait. According to the Oxford University Press, this is defined as online content deliberately designed to elicit anger or outrage by being frustrating, provocative, or offensive. Such content is typically posted in order to increase traffic to websites or social media accounts. Shortlisted words were put to a public vote, the results of which helped to guide the final decision taken by OUP's language experts.
Noor Nanji reporting.
Jane, thank you very much indeed. It is now 9 minutes past seven. The Chancellor toured studios yesterday to make one simple statement. I didn't mislead. I didn't lie about the state of the public finances ahead of the budget. But opponents are demanding an inquiry. We'll hear from the Conservatives at around 10 to 8. We'll hear from a close colleague and ally of the Chancellor's at 20 past 8, I'm sorry. But first of all, let's hear from our political editor, Chris Mason, who has been piecing together who said what, when, and frankly, Chris, also why it matters. Morning to you.
Yeah, morning to you, Nick. So, yeah, there's been this blizzard of headlines, hasn't there, this weekend? The Chancellor being accused of lying, misleading, etc., etc. It's my job, after a careful examination of the facts, to call it on your behalf in careful, precise language. Now, our listener may be thinking, hang on a minute, here's Nick and Chris rabbiting on about politicians who may occasionally lead us on a merry dance of all political colours. What's remotely different about this? Let me explain. In my judgment, on one specific element of what the Chancellor and the Treasury told us, and so told you at home and in the car before the budget, we were misled. So let's be clear. Much of what we heard from the Chancellor in her breakfast speech, that news conference almost 4 weeks ago, reasonably laid the ground for what was to come. Tax rises and big ones, they came. Measures to try to address the cost of living, they came. A desire for more wriggle room in the spreadsheets against her fiscal rules, the so-called headroom, that came. Maintaining long-term investment spending, that came. And that the forecaster, the watchdog, the Office for Budget Responsibility, was revising down its estimate for productivity growth. Productivity is a measure of the output of the economy per hour worked. And yes, Rachel Reeves talked at length about weaker productivity that morning, and by extension, the impact it would have on her numbers, the spreadsheets, the calculations, the trade-offs that she would have to make. In isolation, that did make things harder for her, without question. So in other words, nothing she actually said that morning, Nick, was wrong, but it is what she didn't say, which in my judgment meant that we were misled.
She told us, in your view, only half of what she knew from the number crunchers, the official forecasters at the Office for Budget Responsibility.
Yeah, this is the key point here. We now know that she knew something that she didn't share with us that morning, and that is that tax receipts were much better than expected. And actually, they more than offset the reduction in productivity growth. And in fact, 10 days later, after that news conference, still before the budget, the Treasury did choose to volunteer this fact about tax receipts. You might remember the Financial Times reported that all of the argument going on about whether or not the Chancellor would have to put up income tax rates had been resolved in the Treasury, and they wouldn't have to do that. When that news broke, the markets then wondered, well, hang on a minute, how on earth is she going to make the numbers add up? Hence, there was briefing to me and others intended to be reassuring to those markets, which amounted to saying, without getting into the numbers, and we wouldn't have expected to hear the numbers before, don't worry, tax receipts are much stronger, it's okay. So the Chancellor volunteered to share some of the information she was privy to in that news conference, chose not to share some of the other information she was also privy to, only to then choose to share the thrust of it when she judged it to be politically expedient 10 days later.
Is this more than an argument between politicians and those like you, Chris, who report on what they are told behind the scenes by people they then quote anonymously? Because it seems to me there's a good deal of anger. You can see it in some of the interviews that have been carried out. You can see it in some of the reporting in the newspaper of journalists going, we need to know that what we're told is true in order to then report it to the public who are reading and listening. The question people outside might be thinking is, well, we just expect politicians not to tell us the whole story. What's the fuss about?
Yeah, and I'm well aware, I'm hopefully sufficiently self-aware that I'm conscious that people won't much care whether the likes of me or you or others, you know, might have been told this, that or the other. For me, the crux of this, the absolute crux of this, is not what was whispered into the ears of journalists like me in the run-up to the budget. It was what was chosen to be said in a novel and voluntary news conference that the Chancellor called before the budget. Now, we know why she did it. She did it to set the ground for all those reasons I set out, which were, we should be clear, a perfectly reasonable setting out of the stall of what she was likely to do at that point a few weeks down the track. And her political judgment that given the scale of the budget that was coming, particularly given what she'd said a year before, she absolutely needed to do that so that people weren't surprised when the moment came. But on that specific point about what we were told and what we weren't, I think there's a clear gap there. I should say the Treasury and the Chancellor are of the view that it is unfair to claim that she was misleading. They say that when she gave that news conference, there was a massive gap between where they were numerically and where they wanted to get in terms of the amount of headroom they wanted. In other words, they had to find some big numbers from some big tax rises. They knew it would be a big budget. They had to tell the country exactly that. So they push back on this central claim, but on the basis of the timeline I've walked you through, that's the I hope
that is the conclusion you've
judgment
reached.
That I've come to.
Yeah, Chris Mason, our political editor. Thank you very much indeed. Just to stress, we'll hear from an ally of the Chancellor at 8:20.
It's 7:15 now. New evidence given to the Afghanistan inquiry and released this morning accuses two former heads of UK special forces of suppressing evidence of war crimes carried out during the conflict. The testimony of one senior officer, known at the inquiry as N1466, describes how he was deeply troubled by what he strongly suspected was the unlawful killing of innocent people. And he describes that in his evidence. It's worth saying this is an ongoing inquiry. One of the two men accused of failing to act on evidence of war crimes, those senior officers. One didn't respond to questions from the BBC. The other said that he would give his own denial when his time came to speak to the inquiry. Well, let's speak to Colonel Richard Williams, who served as commanding officer of 22SAS between 2005 and 2008. Good morning.
Good morning, Jim.
Many of the British forces who served in Afghanistan did so with bravery and with distinction. And what N1466, this senior officer, said in his evidence that he didn't want something like this to taint their legacy.
Yes, and he's quite clearly got a view on something that happened or didn't happen from his remote position in London that he's wished to share with the statutory inquiry. And I have to say, I appreciate his sentiment in saying his interpretation shouldn't apply to the actions of every soldier that deployed there. But as I've said, it is his interpretation.
As far as your experience in that job goes, did you ever... As we said, the time at which you were commanding 22SAS was a different period of time to the one in question. But with your experience in that role, did you ever see or suspect that problems were being covered up by senior leaders in the organisation?
No, never. Quite simply. And may I say at this point as well, I find it extraordinary that this selective release of specific statements, which are clearly critical of the actions on the ground, aren't accompanied by statements made by the commanders of those on the ground that are also available now to Haddon Kay. It all seems a bit one-sided to me, this release, and I'm curious about why that is.
It's interesting, yes, because one of the men, as we said, one of the men accused has said that he will give his own comprehensive response when his time comes to give evidence. So if I'm right in thinking, you would actually prefer this all to be released as a whole at the end, as opposed to as time goes on through the inquiry?
Well, this is a very serious set of accusations that have been made that have led to the Secretary of State of Defence and others calling for this statutory inquiry led by Sir Charles Haddon Cave, very serious fellow. And he has a commitment as part of his mandate to transparency and fairness. This is a public inquiry, after all. And by just presenting selectively at this particular moment the critical opinion of one, I question his seniority, actually, because I know who he is, London-based individual, without actually allowing others who were commanding the troops on the ground, who have already provided evidence, to also have their transcript shared, gives a rather unbalanced picture. And I think for all observers, critics, those concerned, supporters, general public, would prefer to have a more balanced position shared. Don't you?
Colonel Richard Williams, thank you for joining us. Commanding officer of 22 SAS between 2005 and 2008. We'll speak to a former veterans minister after 8 o'clock and put that point forward of whether or not when you have a long running inquiry like this one, which has people giving evidence often, as we heard there, using a cipher, there's a lot of secrecy involved, whether or not that staggered release of information is the right way to do things. So we'll talk to Johnny Mercer, former Veterans Minister, about that and more at 10 past eight.
At 20 past seven, there's some news to cheer the Chancellor up, and she needs some of that, doesn't she? One of the city's leading investment banks says it's cautiously optimistic the measures announced in her budget will boost investment on the London Stock Exchange. Will can tell us more.
I can, Nick. Yeah, this is Peel Hunt, FTSE 250 listed investment bank. Have just posted interim financial results this morning that saw both its revenues and profits rise significantly in the 6 months to September. And as you say, the chief executive, Stephen Fine, joins us now. Stephen, morning.
Morning, sir.
Cautiously optimistic, I went for. My words, not yours. But just looking through it, there's sort of two or three measures that you think could make a bit of a difference.
I think probably it's fair to say, despite the pessimism, and don't forget the UK has a long-term confidence level of minus 13, we're naturally pessimistic, there do seem to be a few things going on that are starting to shift a little bit of sentiment. This is budget notwithstanding. We'll put that to one side for the moment. I mean, if I said to you on January the 1st, interest rates would be down, inflation would be down, sterling would be up, market would be at an all-time high, you'd have bitten my arm off. But here we are, and things apparently are still terrible. But I am noticing some signs of corporate mojo, as I call it, coming back here. Number of secondary blocks that have taken place. We've had a few IPOs, definitely a bit of corporate activity taking place. Rose Bank raising money to make a US acquisition, Coates raising money to make a US acquisition. All these things are definitely showing a sign that back foot vulnerability is showing the back foot starting to wobble slightly. Doesn't mean we're front footed at all, but starting to wobble a little bit towards the front.
Where do we need to go further then? I'm thinking in particular issues that were meant in the budget to try and juice the stock market a bit, changes to the cash ISA limit, for example. I mean, were they helpful, but not...
Yes, they're helpful, they're very much a start. I think if you really want to look at the big difference, and I think it goes back to something we've talked about before, Will, which is the domestic bias. I was looking at some statistics. Australia has a 1.6% weighting in the global index. They have 37% weighting from their pension funds to the domestic market. Mm. Italy, 0.7% weighting. They have 41%. Japan, 4.8%. They have 49.4%. We have a 2.8% weighting.
And so changes then, Stephen, to things like salary sacrifice going into pensions, presumably that doesn't bolster pension funds appetite for that type of risk for investing in UK companies?
I don't think it's a question of that kind of risk. The big issue there seems to be this issue of fiduciary duty. And if other countries, Australia, Italy, Japan, France, USA, are perfectly happy to have a significant domestic weighting, we aren't. Are we the outlier on fiduciary duty? That's the bigger question.
And what about what we were just hearing from Chris Mason, the timing, what the Chancellor knew and when, and how much she explained to people like you in the markets and investors? Did that matter economically to you, do you think?
I don't think so. If you look at the aftermath of the budget, I mean, currency is slightly stronger. Gilt yields are back down towards the lows they've been this year. Stock market's still trading at a high. So I think the markets like the fact that there's stability. They probably like the fact that the headroom is so high is a good thing. It allows companies now to plan and not worry about what might be coming next.
Stephen Fine, Chief Executive Peel Hunt, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Will. It's 23 minutes past seven. A tree that is best associated with California is expected to become much more prominent in the landscape here when the government unveils its plan to invest £1 billion in planting new trees. We're supposed to get more detail on this in the next few months, but coast redwoods are likely to be a big part of the trees action plan. It does naturally raise some questions about what that might mean for our native species. Catherine Nutgens is with us, chartered forester who's working in South Yorkshire. Hello, Catherine.
Hello. Hello, Anna.
So tell us a bit more about these coast redwoods and why they might be chosen to be planted instead of the sort of trees that we see around us now.
Well, coast redwoods are part of the toolkit that Forestry England are looking at to diversify the tree stock. Now, coast redwoods in California, they're one of the tallest trees in the world. They grow very quickly. They have that ability to sequester carbon. But it's not just coast redwoods that are needed. It's lots of diverse ranges of species because of things like climate change and pests and diseases that are coming, well, that obviously are changing the environment for our forests in the UK.
So actually a lot of this is trying to guess what problems might come along in the future and trying to plant trees that will be the most resistant to that.
That's right. We need a resilient tree stock. There's been a lot of research done around looking at what trees would be best to cope with much drier, warmer conditions that we're already seeing in this country, and also being able to survive some of the pests and diseases that are coming in, partly as a result of globalisation of timber products and plant products coming in and with these pests and diseases, but also with the changing conditions, species that wouldn't have been able to survive in the past, the diseases and pests that would have died now can survive. And I mean, there's a disease called Phytophthora that has swung through all our larch plantations, and you know, a lot of people might have seen, if they're staying near a larch plantation in Wales or something like that, that there's hundreds of dead trees. So we want to prevent that from happening in the future.
Yeah. What does it mean then for our native species? Is there still a place for them?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's about getting the right tree in the right place for the right reason. So if we look at the kind of principles and biodiversity, what we call the Lawton principles, it's all about having bigger, better and more joined up ecosystems. And I think having a really good plan about how we might be able to do that within our native species that have got that relationship with, you know, British ecosystems and things, making sure that they're in the right place where we need them to go, where they can have the best benefits that they can. Whereas we need timber in the country. We need to have good timber so we're not importing it, we're not bringing in more pests and diseases, and we're able to supply, you know, absolutely sustainable building material. So it's about making sure that we do the best, that we plan really well to make the most of all of those things.
Yeah, looking at the bigger picture, really interesting. Thank you for joining us, Catherine Nutgens, who's a chartered forester in South Yorkshire.
27 minutes past seven. Here's Carthy.
Morning. Thank you very much. A few football headlines to start, and Chelsea were down to 10 men for much of their match against Arsenal, but held on for a 1-1 draw. Arsenal are, though, 5 points clear at the top of the Premier League table. Liverpool had only their second win in 8 league games, a 2-0 victory over West Ham, and Martin O'Neill now has 6 wins in 7 games interim manager of Celtic after they beat Hibs 2-1. Now, McLaren's Lando Norris missed the chance to take the Formula One world title in Qatar yesterday. Red Bull's Max Verstappen won the Qatar Grand Prix, leading to what should be a fascinating final race of the season in Abu Dhabi next weekend. And we can speak to the former McLaren mechanic, Mark Priestley, who's part of the Five Live commentary team. Morning, Mark.
Good morning.
We'll get to Verstappen in a moment. It felt like it was a pretty disastrous weekend for McLaren. In basic terms, McLaren decided not to stop when a safety car was called on lap 7 for a crash between two other drivers. Can you just explain, though, why did that turn out to be such a bad strategy call?
Well, we had a slightly odd situation at the Qatar Grand Prix where Pirelli, the tyre supplier, were concerned about safety, so made a 25-lap limit for any set of tyres. No one could run more than 25 laps. It was a 57-lap race, which meant you would have had to stop twice in the Grand Prix. That safety car you referenced came out on lap 7, so that left 50 laps. Now, you don't need to be a genius to work out that that's two stints on 25. That was the optimum strategy for everybody. McLaren chose not to take that. They left the two cars out on the circuit when the safety car came out, and then you can only imagine their hearts would have sank as every other car on the grid duly peeled into the pit lane behind them, made their pit stop, and then formed up behind them in the queue behind the safety car. And what it meant was, every other driver from that point meant they only had one stop left to make, with McLaren out on track still needing two. It was a horrendous mistake to make. It cost them the race, as you said, opened the door for Verstappen to take victory. And I've got to think, and everybody around Formula One is thinking, this came about because McLaren didn't want to give some sort of unfair treatment or inequality to one of their drivers. They've gone about racing this year, trying to do it in the fairest possible way, which you can understand why. But in doing so, because the second driver, Norris, would have been slightly compromised if they'd both come in together, they ended up compromising them both.
Are they going to have to make that call next weekend between the two drivers?
And this is going to be the problem. They've gone so far down the line of trying to make sure that everything is as fair as it can be. So if they find themselves in a situation next week where they got something similar, they're going to have to continue down the same path, and it could end up costing them the championship. Yeah. Max Verstappen is an incredible driver, and you don't need to open a door very far for him to walk through it, as we saw this weekend. He'll be sitting there with a slight wry smile on his face thinking, this is genuinely on.
He is already a four-time world champion, as you say. He's a brilliant driver. He was 104 points off the lead at the end of August. He's now 12 points off the lead of Lando Norris. Is this partly just his experience paying off?
Well, it's a lot of his experience. I mean, he's an incredible driver in Max Verstappen, but so are the two McLaren drivers. They're less experienced. But as Max Verstappen said himself coming into this weekend, the only reason he's still in the title fight in a car that was nowhere near as dominant as the McLaren for much of this season is because of McLaren's mistakes. And there is a harsh truth to that. They've made a number of errors over the season. You referenced a couple this weekend. They got disqualified in Las Vegas last weekend too. It's not going that well, but the car's been so dominant, they've given themselves the freedom, if you like, or the luxury to sort of absorb a couple of these mistakes and still be in the lead. So they could still win this championship. We might look back on it as a wonderful season for McLaren, but they are not making it easy for themselves.
Yeah, no, they really are. Mark Priestley, really interesting. Thank you very much for talking to us. And it will be the first final race championship showdown between two or more drivers for 15 years. And next weekend will be exciting.
Oh, tense. Thank you, Carthy.
There he is.
My name's Pine. I'm the night manager.
On BBC iPlayer.
Richard Roper is selling arms in the heart of Cairo. I want to put you inside his operation.
You got any idea how dangerous that is?
The brand new series of The Night Manager is coming.
You have to commit.
Get ready by watching Series 1.
Anyone can betray anyone.
You have to make a decision.
Don't you dare threaten me!
The Night Manager.
Oh, I can't wait.
On BBC iPlayer.
So, Cracker, if you missed it, quick look at the weather now. Windy and wet today, but turning drier for a time in the north. Heavy rain in Wales and West England.
Coming up after the news, could progress be made this week on a peace deal between Ukraine and Russia? It feels like we've asked that a few times now over the last few years, doesn't it? And why a rush hour train from Manchester to London is going to be running empty for the next few months?
We will be discussing that. But it is now 28 minutes, or almost 28 minutes to 8, and it's time for a summary of the news with Jane Steele.
Two former heads of UK special forces have been accused of suppressing evidence of war crimes. The claims were made at the public inquiry examining allegations of unlawful killings by the SAS in Afghanistan. A senior officer who can't be named told the hearings that the leadership of the special forces knew there was a problem but did nothing. A court in Bangladesh has found the Labour MP, Tulip Siddiq, guilty of corruption charges in a case linked to her aunt, the ousted Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina. Ms Siddiq is accused of using her influence to secure a plot of land for her family. She was sentenced to 2 years in prison in her absence and fined around £600. But she denies the charges, saying they are politically motivated. The Prime Minister is due to defend his government's budget during a speech later. He's also expected to back his Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, who has denied allegations that she misled the public about the state of the UK's finances. The Conservatives have called for her to resign and written to the Financial Conduct Authority, urging them to carry out an investigation. President Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, is expected to travel to Moscow today to discuss the latest draft of a plan to try to end the war in Ukraine. A Ukrainian official involved in the most recent talks with US negotiators in Florida described them as difficult but productive. A major waste disposal company is warning that vapes are still causing fires on its sites, including in lorries, despite a ban on disposables which came into force 6 months ago. Suez says the damage costs millions. The government says it is compulsory for all vape retailers to provide recycling bins. Rage bait has been named as Oxford University Press's Word of the Year. It's used to refer to online content which aims to annoy or outrage. The other words on the shortlist were aura farming, which is cultivating a cool image, and biohack, which is a change to lifestyle, diet or body to improve health.
Thank you, Jane. 26 minutes to 8 now. More talks have been happening in the US over the weekend to try to refine a potential ceasefire deal between Russia and Ukraine. Ukrainian negotiators travelled to Florida to meet their American counterparts. It is a meeting which the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio described as productive, while also saying that more work was needed. That work involves making a deal, really, that would also be acceptable to Russia. President Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff, is due to travel to Moscow for further talks this week. Again, it is a moment where there was an early burst of momentum, which now seems to have slowed considerably. Let's get the thoughts of Jeremy Bowen, our international editor. Jeremy, at this stage, as these talks continue, does it feel that we are edging closer to an agreement which will be agreeable, I suppose, to both sides?
No, I don't think it does. The reason I say that is because the Russians have actually been very consistent about what he wants. And essentially, he wants a Ukraine where its sovereignty is deeply compromised, where he takes territory which Russia hasn't even conquered yet, and which the Ukrainians have sacrificed thousands of men trying to defend up to now. And, you know, at the same time, the Ukrainians, I think, are very, very reluctant to give up the territory, make the concessions. Effectively, the original deal that the Americans and the Russians came up with was something that amounted to a capitulation. So I think what you're talking about, some of the fundamentals of the conflict here. And the impetus seems to come from President Trump deciding, right, we've got to go and do this now. But actually, the realities in terms of what's possible don't fit in with that. And, you know, there's a limit to what his will, thus far anyway, can achieve.
What about the issues that have been happening in Ukraine, Jeremy? There's a new chief negotiator now after President Zelensky's right-hand man essentially was removed. He was sacked during this corruption inquiry that's going on. Has that changed, certainly as far as President Trump's concerned, has that changed Ukraine's position?
It's bound to make negotiations a little bit more complicated, different faces, different voices. The question, though, is the consistency of the position coming from the Ukrainians that does not seem to have changed. These things have happened before. At the end of the Second World War, there was a change of government in Britain, and instead of Winston Churchill going to summits, Clement Attlee went to summits as Britain's Prime Minister at the end of World War II in 1945. We somehow got through all of that. So just because your Mac isn't there doesn't mean to say nothing is going to happen. I think what you're hearing now from the Ukrainians is, of course, they want to try and keep the Americans happy because they need them. They need that relationship. But at the same time, both the Ukrainians and their European allies, not least Britain itself and the French, are pretty horrified by the kind of deal that the Americans were proposing to put forward, which was essentially a list of Russian talking points.
Jeremy Bowen, our international editor, thank you for your insight as always. Let's also speak to Oleksandr Mereshko, who's chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the Ukrainian Parliament. Good morning.
Good morning.
It must be a source of frustration to you and to your colleagues that the corruption scandal in Ukraine has forced the change of the negotiating team, has meant that has become a talking point, really, as these discussions continue.
Well, the thing is that the whole negotiating process is a collective endeavor, and it doesn't change. It's not important who is the leader at the moment and what is the composition of the delegation, because lots of people are involved in this process of talks, and that's why I'm sure that it won't have any serious consequences for the course of negotiations and for effectiveness of the Ukrainian team.
Yeah, it shows Ukraine in a poor light internationally, though, doesn't it? At a difficult time for the country.
Yes, it is a difficult time, but at the same time, it illustrates that we are serious about fighting corruption, and it doesn't matter who was implicated or involved in the corruption. No one has immunity, and even people at the top can be brought to justice. I think it's a good example of fighting corruption for all the countries.
Where do the Ukrainian red lines remain, particularly when it comes to Ukrainian territory and the fact that the US plans keep suggesting that is given to Russia?
The crux of the matter is that Americans are trying to do the impossible thing, because they're trying to reconcile absolutely irreconcilable positions. Russia wants us to surrender, and Ukraine doesn't want to surrender. We want to survive as an independent sovereign state. In particular, Russia, Putin, he wants to take under control without a fight the rest of the territory of the Donetsk region. And Putin has failed to take it by military hands. So he's trying to reach the result by using negotiations and by using some our American colleagues. But of course, we cannot agree to that, because it's not about territories. It's about people living in these territories. And it would be hugely, not only illegal, but also immoral to sacrifice people, Ukrainians living in this territory, to subject them to Russian genocide against Ukrainian nation.
You talked about the US trying to do the impossible, trying to find a place between the Ukrainian and the Russian position that everybody can agree on. Do you think that exists? Do you think there is any movement at all from the Ukrainian side that can move you closer to a position of compromise?
I believe that we even don't need negotiations in this regard, because negotiations for Russia, for Putin, is only a tool of war. We should be realistic, and common sense should prevail, which means that we should revert to the initial Mr. Trump's plan with regard to unconditional ceasefire. And to do that, we need to put maximum pressure on Russia. And for that, you don't need negotiations, because Russians will definitely use negotiations for only one purpose: to buy time and to try to put the blame on Ukraine, to discredit Ukraine.
The great difficulty remains, of course, that if nobody moves, then the war continues. And nobody wants that either.
We cannot afford to stop fighting, because we know that if we stop defending ourselves, we'll be just eliminated as a nation. But everything depends on Putin. He is the only roadblock, the only obstacle to peace, even to ceasefire. And to deal with him, to stop him, he's totally obsessed about destroying Ukraine. And to prevent him from destroying us is the only way is... actually, two ways. First of all, more weaponry for Ukraine and more serious sanctions against Russia and on Russian allies.
Oleksandr Mereshko, the chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the Ukrainian Parliament, thank you for being with us.
It's 19 minutes to 8. Will passengers for the train from Manchester to London Euston please not board now? This is what you, Anna Foster, might hear in a couple of weeks' time if you head to Piccadilly to catch the early train to the capital. Not that the 0700 to London won't be running anymore. Deary me, no. It will run. It just won't have any passengers. It will be a ghost train.
I read this story several times, and I'm not afraid to admit I still don't understand it. So what? I'm going to pay very close attention to the conversation you're about to have.
We have the man who can explain it, because he's the former chair of the Strategic Rail Authority, Richard Bowker, co-presenter of the Green Signals Railway podcast. Morning to you, Richard.
Good morning, Nick.
Why in God's name would you run a train with nobody on it?
Well, that's a very fair question. It is a bonkers decision, frankly. The reason is because the West Coast main line is very full. It's very busy. It's got worse, actually, recently. The regulator has allowed more services onto it. There's some open access services starting early next year. And despite the fact that Avanti, they must run this train because it comes up to Manchester the night before, it's got to get back to London in the morning, because it then forms the 9:30 to Glasgow, which is a really important train because it's the first off-peak one to Glasgow. So it has to run. Network Rail are happy for it to run, despite the issues on the West Coast main line. But the regulator has said no, because they're worried about the performance impact of that train being there.
The performance impact. So it's better for the railway's performance, presumably, if no trains run at all, because then nothing's going to be delayed.
Now, I sort of said what the regulator were justifying this on with a sort of a bit of an inverted commas, really. No, of course it's not. It's a crazy decision. It has to run. It has to run pretty sharpish. It can't be messed around with, because it's got to get to London in time to run the 9:30.
But is that the worry, Mr. Bowker? Are they, to be fair to them for a second, are they saying, look, the difficulty with having passengers on board this train is that might slow it down, getting people on and off. If it slows down, then that train will disrupt other trains. Is that the kind of logic of their thinking?
Well, it may be, but I don't get even that. This train starts from Manchester Piccadilly at 7 o'clock. It stops once at Stockport, I think at 7:09 to pick up, and then it runs non-stop to London. So it's not as if it's stopping at multiple places. I mean, the West Coast is really busy. There's no question about that. But this does not seem to be a rational decision despite that. And I think, really, my understanding is this could be turned back into a passenger train very quickly. And I think that's what they need to do. They just need to sit down and say, whoops, we made a mistake with this one. This doesn't make sense. Everybody's happy, including Network Rail, and they're usually the ones that are the most cautious. Let's get it back into the timetable. That's what they should do.
Yeah, unless they just cancel them all and say, there we are. Everything's running really swimmingly now.
Well, we shouldn't do that. This is a very popular and very profitable train, actually. So it needs to be back in the timetable.
Well, Richard, thank you for trying to make that clear. You did your best. Perhaps the Office for Rail Regulator want to get in touch and they can tell us what's really going on. That's the former chair of the Strategic Rail Authority there, co-presenter of the Green Signals Railway podcast.
It is nearly 7:45, seemingly moving on to rage bait, which has been named the word, or two words technically, of 2025 by the Oxford University Press. It's come from analysis of the way that we use language, as well as a survey of more than 30,000 people. And who better to explain that and the other words that were in the running to us than Susie Dent, lexicographer. Susie, good morning.
Good morning, Anna.
You'll notice I haven't tried to explain what rage bait is, because I thought it was far better left to you.
Well, thank you. There's one goal, really, with rage bait, and that's to produce content online that will make other people viscerally angry. And then the person producing it will bask in the millions, quite often, of comments and shares and even likes sometimes. So it is all really to do with the algorithms of social media, because although we love fluffy cats, we'll appreciate that, we tend to engage more with negative content and content that really provokes us. And the algorithms will then amplify that and, crucially, will actually earn money for the social media platforms and for the influencers too. So we're sort of caught in this cycle, which, of course, is quite depressing for the rest of us, because we remain feeling incredibly angry all day. But pretty indicative of the times, I would say.
It is very zeitgeisty, isn't it? As is aura farming, which is another one that was in there.
Yes. I think if you mention the word aura to anyone under 20, they will just laugh their heads off, because it's very much one for, I think, their generation. But also it's to do, again, with authenticity. It's to do with curating ourselves online so that we look great, or we, you know, we sort of emphasize a particular angle of our lives. But for teenagers, aura is a big thing. They will, if someone sort of trips up and it's caught on camera, that's negative aura. If you are photographed doing something amazing, that's positive aura, plus 1,000 aura, etc. So it's become quite a big word. And aura farming is simply that, curating so that we have, to use a previous word of the year, a lot of riz.
Oh, a lot of riz. I do love the way that you keep up to date with not only the very oldest words, but the new ones as well, that even for those of us who are parents are just impenetrable when the kids come out with them. Speaking of which, if you biohack, then presumably you can farm a better aura. I hope my kids aren't listening to this, because they're going to be heads in hands before they go to school.
Likewise, yes. So this is really just a buzzword for the wellness trends that we will see, increasingly just attract us and seduce us online. I guess some people have said this is a desire for control in a world that seems quite chaotic. And it's all about prolonging our lives through, sleep optimization or particular diets, etc. It's hacks for living longer, essentially.
Yeah. And for people who look at these and say, oh, these silly new words, actually, it's all about the richness of language, the way it evolves and changes. And it's like a history of who we are and how we speak.
Exactly. And I think you only have to look at previous words. You know, if I was to say to you boogie woogie or D-mob or hemline or perm, you might think, yeah, that's 1920s. It's such a vivid collage of the time. Mm-hmm. 1940s, you'll have, blitz or big brother or nylons, etc. So they do speak volumes about our preoccupations. In this case, I guess quite a depressing one as to, what is authentic and what isn't, whether it's the information we're being given, the images we see, or indeed, how people are presenting themselves online. So I think it is quite telling. And who knows whether we will become offline. It's increasingly difficult to draw a distinction, actually, between online and offline. And
it is. It merges together, doesn't it? Susie Dent, it's always good to talk to you. Thank you so much. I think our aura is on point this morning.
Yes. Have you farmed your aura, then?
I haven't farmed it yet, but maybe I will later.
You need to spend more time on it.
I do. I definitely do.
It's coming up to 11 minutes to 8. It's time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is Anna Rowlands, Professor of Catholic Social Thought and Practice at the University of Durham.
Good morning. This morning, as many of us will, I'll open the first door of my Advent calendar. I'm fascinated that this tradition has endured, even as much else about Advent has been overshadowed by all things Christmas. We owe the origins of the Advent calendar to 19th and 20th century German Lutherans, who also bequeathed us Dietrich Bonhoeffer, one of the most striking writers on the Advent season. Bonhoeffer, famous for his resistance to fascism, loved this season, but his vision of it was far from gentle, festive ease. Bonhoeffer's sermon for the first week of Advent in 1931 addressed a culture at a turning point, a culture he described as an age of world views. He wrote that how a person dresses, eats, speaks, and even exercises was now being read as evidence of worldviews clashing with increasing violence. At the root of these disagreements about worldview was the struggle to define human value. Who has value, who decides on the terms of that human value. Bonhoeffer said he was afraid of a culture that answered that question by equating human value with mastery over ourselves, the world and other people. He warned us against desiring leaders, political or religious, who promise an impoverished vision of mastery and triumph. He was afraid of an impatient culture, tempted by easy answers that turn out to be very costly. Bonhoeffer finds in Advent a better story of what it means to be human, a story that teaches us expectant waiting. He preaches it as a season of restless desire and liberation from the substitute counterfeit gods that get in the way of a more just future. He thinks those who are powerless and restless in spirit often grasp best what Advent is. Advent rewards those who yearn for a new world, but who will wait until it is one capable of being good news for all, one which will come as a child for whom there is no room. His model of those closest to the spirit of Advent is the prisoner, which he himself became, and the pregnant woman. The church lights a candle on its Advent wreath for each of the four virtues of the season: hope, peace, joy, and love. In an age of worldviews in which rival visions of the future once again abound, these remain candles worth lighting in the darkness.
That was Thought for the Day with Anna Rowlands, Professor of Catholic Social Thought and Practice at the University of Durham. It is 8:09.
Did the Chancellor lie? Did she mislead people, MPs, the markets, ahead of her budget? That is the political row which Rachel Reeves has so far failed to quell. In a moment, we'll talk about what consequences, if any, the argument is having and has had in the real world with the former boss of Sainsbury's, Justin King. First, though, the politics. The Conservatives have written to the financial regulators to say they do think there's been a breach of the rules here. And I've been speaking about that with the Shadow Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, Alex Burghaus. I asked him to explain to people why he thinks this is worse than what politicians do, frankly, all of the time.
If you try and manipulate the gilt market, then that is a very serious offence. I mean, it's literally an offence.
It's a serious charge. In what way did she manipulate
because
the gilt
if you
market?
Right, so if you provide false information in order to manipulate a market, that's if you say that something is going on with your finances, that is not, then you have broken the law. And you'll have seen people who are leaders in the city who have been tweeting since the budget or since this became apparent, saying if this was a private company, the executives would be sacked and they would potentially face criminal prosecution.
But so, in what look, way did not- the Chancellor gain from what you claim was misleading briefings about the state of the public finances before they were actually published?
Because you remember the Cheerios announcement where the Chancellor gives an emergency statement saying things are worse than I thought. I'm going to, although she didn't actually say I'm going to put up income tax, all of her people were going around briefing. And it's not, look,
the problem with your argument, isn't it, Mr. Burghaus? She didn't actually say it. So what you're saying is she hinted it, nudged it, there were briefings, there's off-the-record stuff?
Yeah, that's right. But it was done in such a way as to leave people in no doubt. And you can see how angry journalists are across Fleet Street because they feel they were misled. And it's not just journalists, it's members of her own cabinet. You'll have seen the story in the Times today where a member of the cabinet is saying we were not told the truth.
But you're making a more serious charge. You're saying that the Chancellor of the Exchequer manipulated the financial markets in such a way that you think there should be an investigation into it.
I'm saying that this should absolutely be investigated, and that's why Mel Stride, the Shadow Chancellor, has written to the FCA. Everybody knows that this goes way beyond the normal briefing in advance of a budget. But it had come in this sort of cloud of dishonesty, of taxes that were going to be risen and taxes that were going to be taken away and entirely misleading statements over what welfare spending was going to be.
Forgive me, you've been very persistent in insisting the Chancellor was misleading.
Yes.
Let me just put to you this. You say that she only raised our taxes because of welfare spending. That is misleading. That's not what's in the... Let me just finish the question. That is not what's in the financial books, is it? There was a lot of extra money set aside for what's called headroom, the kind of buffer to make sure that the markets don't get nervous about the numbers adding up. That's one reason our taxes went up. There was a decision made not to cut public spending. That's another reason that our taxes went up. And yes, welfare spending was increased as well. That's all apparent. Everyone can make a judgment on whether they politically agree with that or they don't agree with that, can't they?
Well, you're being a little misleading there because I never said that taxes only went up because of benefits. But taxes did go up because of benefits, £16 billion. And those were choices that the Chancellor made that she didn't have to make. And that's why everybody listening this morning, working people, their taxes are going up because the Chancellor has chosen to increase welfare spending.
Precisely what the Conservatives did in office, put taxes up in order to pay for increased welfare spending.
Something that she did not need to do.
Is that not exactly what you did in office, Mr. Burghaus?
Look, when we were in office, we dealt with the biggest pandemic in a century. What's happened here is that the Chancellor made bad choices last November, and those bad choices have now pushed her into a position where she is making further bad choices this year. And the people who are suffering are the people listening to your show.
Alex Burkhardt, the Shadow Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, talking for the Conservatives. We'll hear from Darren Jones, the Prime Minister's right-hand man, at about 20 past eight. Let's turn, though, to a representative of the real world, Justin King. He used to be the boss of Sainsbury's. Recently, he was on the board of M&S as well. Morning to you, Justin. Look, politicians often throw around these sorts of allegations. Do they matter in your world? Did they make a difference? And are they making a difference to how businesses invest and what the markets think?
Well, yes, they do. Is the thought that was in my head as I was listening to that piece is I don't mind overly much that politicians are upset or indeed journalists are upset. But this whole debate has had real world consequences. The choosing of the budget date when it was, the very long run into that during a key trading period for hospitality and retail in this country, the briefing week after week after week. And yes, I would agree the misleading position that the Chancellor took a few weeks before the budget in a speech that she didn't need to make had the budget been in its more traditional timing. All of that has real world consequences, consequences on investment, job creation, and therefore ultimately tax paying.
Why so? She gives a speech in which she says, look, things are bad, I'm going to have to put your taxes up, was effectively the message of that breakfast speech she gave the other day. And the Conservatives say, well, look, they weren't as bad as she said. But in what way was that damaging to business?
Well, look, I mean, clearly there's a political device there, which is to lower expectation and then achieve something slightly better, which she hoped, and we'll see, would have a positive effect on consumer sentiment, consumers being the people that actually pay those taxes. But we have seen, really going all the way back to the budget a year ago, real-world consequences for tax rises. Last year's tax rises impacted on jobs. There are fewer vacancies, more people chasing them, more young people out of work than there were a year ago. And that uncertainty impacts on consumer expenditure. Actually, we're seeing quite a high savings ratio at the moment. Wages on average, and I recognise that average covers a multitude of sins, going up faster than inflation. But consumers are frightened, and they have been frightened by the to-ing and fro-ing ahead of this budget. And it's impacted on their confidence, consumer spending, and therefore, as I said, jobs and people who can afford to pay those new taxes.
Justin King, thank you very much indeed.
Let's check the weather. Here's Simon King.
Anna, thanks so much indeed. Yeah, it's very wet to start the day for many of us, and the rain is going to be particularly heavy around western hills of England and Wales. For South Wales, we've got an amber warning from the Met Office. That's the second highest warning, with up to a month's worth of rain falling here today. There is the real chance of flooding. The rain is going to continue for much of England and Wales on and off really into the evening and even for the first part of the night as well. Some of that rain really will be quite heavy, some gusty winds associated with it as well, particularly around coastal areas and over hills, and where you get some heavy and thundery showers moving eastward. Maximum temperatures getting up to about 11 to 14 degrees. Now, Scotland and Northern Ireland, again, pretty wet at times, but actually not quite as wet. It's just the far southwest of Scotland where they'll see the heaviest of the rain, and again, the risk of some localised flooding here. Rain will continue, though, for a little bit for a time, but for northern Scotland, it's looking drier this afternoon. There'll be some sunshine as well, and maximum temperatures getting to about 6 to 10 Celsius.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson.
Good morning, it's 8 o'clock on Monday, the 1st of December. The headlines this morning, the public inquiry into allegations of unlawful killing by the SAS in Afghanistan has been told that two former heads of UK Special Forces suppressed evidence of war crimes. A former Veterans Minister who's also given evidence to the inquiry will join us after the news. A court in Bangladesh has found the Labour MP, Tulip Siddiq, guilty in her absence of corruption charges. And the Prime Minister will use a speech later today to set out the case for welfare reform and to defend his Chancellor against allegations of misleading the public in the run-up to the budget.
Also in the next hour, descendants of the former US President John F. Kennedy and the Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev unite for a new BBC programme on the Cuban Missile Crisis. We hear their story.
I was in this very dual relationship with history. On one hand, it was a family story, was a good decision for him to make. At school, no, it was a very wrong thing to do.
And to pay tribute to the founder of the independent newspaper, Sir Andreas Whittam Smith, who has died, who better than the man who got a job from him, Amel, who was editor of The Independent will join us later. That's all after the BBC News, read for us this morning by Jane Steele.
Two former heads of UK special forces have been accused of suppressing evidence of war crimes. The claims were made at the public inquiry examining allegations of unlawful killings by the SAS in Afghanistan. A senior officer, who can't be named, told the hearings that the leadership of the special forces knew there was a problem but did nothing. Richard Bilton is from the BBC's Panorama programme, whose reports helped prompt the inquiry.
This is significant testimony. The officer, who gave evidence in closed session without the public present, was one of the most senior in UK Special Forces. He told the inquiry he was deeply troubled by what he strongly suspected was the unlawful killing of innocent people, including children. He said two former heads of UK Special Forces knew of the allegations of war crimes but failed to act. We contacted the men he named. One didn't respond. The other denied the accusations and said he would provide a comprehensive response in his evidence to the inquiry in due course. A Ministry of Defence spokesperson said the government was fully committed to supporting the independent inquiry, but added they would wait for the outcome before commenting further.
Colonel Richard Williams, a former commanding officer in the SAS, told us the accusations from the unnamed senior officer may not be a reflection of the whole picture.
He's quite clearly got a view on something that happened or didn't happen from his remote position in London that he's wished to share with the statutory inquiry. And I have to say, I appreciate his sentiment in saying his interpretation shouldn't apply to the actions of every soldier that deployed there. But it is his interpretation.
The Labour MP, Tulip Siddiq, has been found guilty of corruption charges in Bangladesh and sentenced to 2 years in prison. She was tried in her absence by a court in the capital, Dhaka. Ms Siddiq denied the charges, which she called fabricated. Arunade Mukherjee reports from outside the court in Dhaka.
Tulip Siddiq was convicted of using her power and influence over her aunt Sheikh Hasina, the former Prime Minister of Bangladesh, to obtain a plot of land for her mother on the outskirts of Dhaka. Ms Siddiq, a former Treasury Minister, is being investigated by Bangladesh's Anti-Corruption Commission as part of a wider probe into her aunt's regime. Ms Hasina was deposed last year during anti-government protests. The judge also fined Ms Siddiq 100,000 Bangladeshi taka, which is roughly a little over £600, and warned that if she fails to pay, 6 more months will be added to her sentence. The UK and Bangladesh have no formal extradition treaty. Ms Siddiq's lawyers have denied the allegations and dismissed the trial as politically motivated. Separately, Ms Siddiq is also facing other accusations of embezzlement and using fake documents to transfer property, charges she has also rejected.
Keir Starmer will use a speech in London later today to defend his government's budget and commit to reforming the welfare state. He's also expected to back his Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, who has denied allegations that she misled the public about the state of the UK's finances in the build-up to the budget. The Conservatives have called for her to resign. Our political correspondent Joe Pike reports.
In his speech, the Prime Minister will say our welfare state is trapping people, not just in poverty, but out of work. Young people especially, and that is a poverty of ambition. But while Sir Keir wants to talk about welfare reform and economic growth, he is likely to face questions about whether his Chancellor has been honest. That is due to her interventions in the weeks building up to the budget. We now know that the economic forecasts she received in private were more upbeat than the impression left by her appearances in public. She told the BBC yesterday she did not accept she'd been misleading. But the Conservatives have written to the Financial Conduct Authority calling for an investigation. They argue the Chancellor's pre-budget statements had an impact on the markets and on people's mortgages. The Liberal Democrats want the Chancellor to be hauled before the Commons to explain herself, while Reform UK is calling on the government's ethics adviser to investigate.
President Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, is expected to travel to Moscow today with the latest draft of a peace plan after talks in Florida between senior American and Ukrainian officials on ending the war with Russia. Mr. Trump said there was a good chance the US could make a deal, as our North America correspondent Sean Dilley reports.
The president struck a positive tone as he prepared to board Air Force One. He said he wanted to stop people being killed and he believed Russia wanted to see it ended too. The talks followed discussions last week in Geneva when Europeans and Ukrainians appeared to have modified an original 28-point American plan, which was widely seen as heavily favouring Russia. Earlier, the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio described the talks as delicate and complicated, but he insisted officials were optimistic. The Ukrainian National Security Advisor Rustem Umerov again thanked the United States and its leadership. But with Kyiv having ruled out ceding more territory or limiting the size of its military, the future shape of any peace agreement with Russia remains unclear.
Virgin Media has been fined £23.8 million by the regulator Ofcom for putting thousands of vulnerable customers at direct risk of harm when moving them to digital landlines. Ofcom began its investigation after incidents in November and December 2023 and described what had happened as unacceptable. A major waste disposal firm has warned that vapes are still causing fires in rubbish lorries and waste facilities 6 months after the ban on disposables came into force. Suez says it has seen more than one fire a day in its network this year, causing millions of pounds of damage. The government says it is compulsory for all vape retailers to provide recycling bins. Ben King reports.
Suez handles household waste for more than 50 local authorities and runs over 300 sites around the UK. It says people are still treating reusable vapes as disposable, throwing away large numbers of the devices which contain lithium batteries. These can catch fire when crushed in the waste system. Suez called for a more ambitious plan to tackle cheap throwaway vapes, such as a nationwide recycling scheme paid for by producers. A body representing the vape industry said the number of devices sold had fallen by more than a half since the ban was introduced, but called for greater consumer education on how to dispose of them responsibly. Vapes should be put in specialised recycling bins, not general recycling or waste.
The Pope is meeting religious leaders and young people on the second day of his visit to Lebanon. Yesterday he urged the Lebanese people not to abandon their country, where many fear a return to conflict between Hezbollah fighters and Israel. Our religion editor Ali McBool is travelling with the Pope.
The duration of the papal visit to Lebanon has been declared a national holiday. It's been a boost to the third of the country that's estimated to be Christian, but Pope Leo's already been welcomed by people of all other major faiths here too, his arrival coming as it does, just a week after Israeli airstrikes hit Beirut. Even Hezbollah, the Shia Muslim militia and political party that many, including the UK, consider a terrorist organisation, said they welcomed and had deep appreciation for his presence. Talking about the broader issues in the region on the flight here, the Pope said the only solution to the decades-old conflict would involve a Palestinian state. And while he said Israel didn't agree with that, he still called Israel a friend and said he was here to be a messenger of peace.
An amber weather warning for rain is in effect in South Wales until midnight, meaning there's likely to be disruption and flooding of homes and businesses. Up to 120 millimetres of rain is expected in places. Ragebait has been named Oxford University Press's Word of the Year. The phrase refers to online content designed to provoke anger and encourage people to click on it. The lexicographer Susie Dent says it's a fitting choice given how technology and social media algorithms have become more sophisticated in recent years.
We might see a cute kitten and admire it and scroll past it, but then we see something that makes us so angry we engage. We share with sort of, you know, the same outrage, and then it is amplified by the algorithm, which maintains that level of anger. And crucially for the influencers who are producing it, it pays them because social media platforms tend to love this kind of content. So it's all in one sort of cycle, if you like.
A lifeboats team, police officers and the Coast Guard have worked together to capture a reindeer which escaped from a Christmas event in Merseyside. Using thermal binoculars, quad bikes and a drone, the animal was found after several hours on Formby Beach. Buddy, who goes by Rudolph during the festive season, has now been returned home.
Thank you, Jane. Good news. It's 8:10 now. They are described as some of the best and the brightest in the British military. The UK's special forces have played a leading role in conflicts around the world for decades. But this morning, two former heads of the SAS stand accused of suppressing evidence of war crimes carried out by their men during the conflict in Afghanistan. The Afghanistan inquiry was set up after a BBC Panorama reported that 54 civilians were killed by the SAS in suspicious circumstances during one six-month tour of duty in 2011. The inquiry is currently in progress, and today's news comes from the release of evidence given by members of Special Forces who were present. They were questioned about alleged murders between 2010 and 2014. One senior officer has been given the codename N1466 at the inquiry to protect his identity. He said he was deeply troubled by what he suspected was the unlawful killing of women and children by British soldiers. The leadership of the Special Forces at the time knew that, he claims, but did nothing to stop it or to pursue those responsible for it. He calls that a conscious decision. Now, one particular incident is recalled by N1466. He describes how Special Forces members went to clear a compound and on entering a room found people hiding under a mosquito net. They did not reveal themselves, he explains, so Special Forces shot at the net until there was no movement. When the net was uncovered, it was women and children. The incident was covered up, he goes on to claim, and the individual who did the shooting was allegedly given some form of award to make it look legitimate. Well, the BBC has asked those two former heads of UK Special Forces whether they did cover up war crimes. One didn't respond. The other said that he would provide his own comprehensive response when he gives evidence to the Afghanistan inquiry in due course. Well, let's speak to Johnny Mercer, who is a former Conservative Veterans Minister who was also himself given evidence to the inquiry. Good morning.
Morning.
During your time in government, you were tasked with investigating this very topic. So how does a piece of evidence like this fit with what you learned during that time?
Well, look, I mean, it's incredibly difficult, I think, for everybody concerned. I think that you can see what should be happening in private playing out in public. I don't really understand why these things are kind of pushed out and this information is released in this way, because it drives into this narrative that we seem to have in this country that soldiers behave badly and that, you know, these investigations should go on for years afterwards. That said, clearly there are questions to be answered. And, you know, I think the context of these statements is missing. And I would urge caution against reading, you know, only one side of what has happened here. That said, you know, I gave my evidence, and a lot of us know who these individuals are behind these ciphers, and we know this evidence exists, and we want answers, and we want answers from this inquiry. And I'm concerned it's going on so long, and that it is, you know, the process is in danger, I think, of compromising what should be a very serious outcome.
Colonel Richard Williams made a similar point on the programme an hour ago, former CO of 22SAS. And so we did actually put that to the inquiry. So I'll just tell you what they said in response. They said, as the chair of the inquiry emphasised in a recent update, the inquiry is investigating the deliberate execution of Afghan males. It's not about split-second decisions taken in combat. As with other statutory public inquiries, we are legally required to publish what evidence we can when we can, having regard to the need to protect the identity of members of UK Special Forces and national security. These publications are intended to keep the public informed of the progress of our investigation and to encourage those who have relevant evidence to give to contact the inquiry. So that is why they're saying that we're getting these releases of information and evidence when, as you say, evidence on the other side has not yet been given. They're saying it's because of the particularly complex nature of this. Are you supportive of what the inquiry is trying to do?
Well, of course I am, because it's a very serious situation. The allegations have to be looked into correctly and thoroughly. And it speaks to the professionalism of a whole cohort of individuals that, you know, many of us knew and saw operated at the highest levels in extremely challenging circumstances in Afghanistan. And I think, you know, people do support it, because actually the military isn't full of people who want to go out and break the law and murder civilians and children. And actually, you know, the vast majority, and certainly everyone I engaged with, demonstrated the best qualities that we know the UK Armed Forces is for. But I think if you're going to release that one side of the information, you should, you know, at the same time, release direct answers to that, so that people at least get a balanced view of what's going on, so that when the inquiry does come to an end and produces what it's going to produce, people can look at it with a fair mind and see what has actually happened here. So look, I mean, I've been as conflicted as this, on this, as much as anybody else. I spent 7-8 years in Parliament trying to stop the establishment going after UK forces for all sorts of actions that were found to be complete, you know, tissues of lies by public inquiries in Iraq and Afghanistan. So of course I want to know what happened here. But we're not going to get there by selectively releasing bits of commentary that fit a certain narrative.
You've always been a staunch defender of your former colleagues. And when I say that, I'm not specifically talking about people involved in incidents like this. I'm meaning in general. But you have said in the past that something doesn't stack up with this for you, and that you do have people who have told you about allegations of murder, who've passed that on to you. So there is something, it would appear, in this.
Oh, look, I don't think anybody suggests that. And I don't think, you know, my evidence is my evidence, and I'm not going to repeat it here. But, you know, my point is the process has to be fair. It has to be fair to all sides. It has to be seen to be fair as well. I'm not sure that is what's happening here. Clearly, you know, allegations of this nature have to be looked into. I had my own struggles with that. It's been a deeply conflicting time for me and for a whole load of other people who are involved in this process. But it has to be done fairly. It has to be done professionally. And everything's sort of born in context and in the round.
Even given that explanation from the inquiry themselves, that they are in line with other statutory public inquiries, that they are legally required to publish what they can when they can. They say they are working within the framework that they have to operate within, but you still don't feel that's fair.
Well, I think you have to be careful about what you're releasing then, because you then have to provide both sides of what has actually happened. Because if you release all of one side of the argument, it gets a lot of coverage in the papers and so on, and then a year later you release all sides of one side of the argument and nobody listens to it and it doesn't get any coverage because it's not sensationalist or anything like that, you're not going to get a fair and accurate picture of what's gone on. So, you know, whilst many of us have had our own difficulties with this process, it has to be fair. It has to be fair to the men on the ground. It has to be fair to those who are going through it. What is a deeply, deeply traumatic process of having to go and give evidence and dip deep into the well of integrity as to what happened during those times? You know, and people are doing that. But I think the way that these things are released with one side and not the other is not the way to do things.
Johnny Mercer, former Conservative Veterans Minister, thank you.
It is now 19 minutes past eight. I didn't mislead, I didn't lie about the state of the public finances, the Chancellor insists, but that is not convincing her opponents, who point to the repeated briefings by the Treasury and by the Chancellor herself ahead of the budget, which suggested there was a black hole in the public finances, which would have to be filled by tax rises. A black hole which wasn't actually there. Darren Jones is Chief Secretary to the Prime Minister. He was the Chancellor's deputy, and he sits, crucially, on what is called the Budget Board of Senior Ministers and Advisers, who sign off the budget proposals. Delighted to say, joins us from Westminster. Morning to you.
Good morning.
When did you first learn, as a member of the Budget Board, that there was, in fact, no black hole in the public finances?
Well, the first part of your question is, when were the OBR figures shared with Number 10? And as the Prime Minister's made clear, those were shared on a rolling basis in what we call the scorecard, essentially a big Excel spreadsheet from the Treasury. The second part of your question assumes that there wasn't a funding gap, but there was, because what the forecast showed in the fifth round was that there was £4 billion of unallocated spending predicted in the year 2030. But that was before you even get to what's called the headroom, where you have to have money put aside in case something goes wrong. That was £10 billion in the budget last year. Everyone was clear, including the Chancellor, that needed to be higher. So that's £20 billion. So you've already got a £16 billion gap. And then we wanted to take interventions to support people with the cost of living, for example, cutting energy bills and supporting payments for child poverty, as well as protecting our investment in the National Health Service and other decisions that we taken in the last budget. So that's essentially how you got to the number, the £26 billion of additional money.
Yeah, but my question, you see, was a different question. That is interesting and important and explains what the Chancellor called her choices. You chose, as the Labour Party, to spend money on public services and on welfare and other spending. You chose to increase the headroom. Absolutely fine. That's exactly what politics is about, making those sorts of choices. My question was, when did you first learn there was no black hole in the public finances? There wasn't a black hole. The Office for Budget Responsibility told you there wasn't a black hole. And yet the Chancellor continued to brief people that there was a black hole. When did you first learn the truth?
So, as I say, there are two things relevant here. The OBR did downgrade its assumptions about how much money was coming in over future years by looking at the past 10 years. That is true and correct. And as I say, there was a funding gap.
Funding gap is a different point, as you know. A funding gap is a gap between what you want to do and what you've raised taxes to. I'm asking you about the official economic forecasts produced by an organisation set up to stop politicians playing fast and loose with economic forecasts. And you're denying the truth, aren't you, Mr. Jones? They told you there wasn't a funding black hole.
No, Nick. You would be rightly accusing me and the Chancellor of not taking the right decisions on behalf of the country if we only had £4 billion of headroom by the year 2030.
That's a different question, Mr. Jones. I'm asking you when you knew that the Treasury officials, now in the Office for Budget Responsibility, told you that there was no black hole in the public finances.
Well, the second half of your question is the thing I disagree with. There was a funding gap, and there always was through that budget process. Yes. And as I say, as I've already answered to the first part of your question, numbers were shared between number 11 and number 10 on a continuous basis.
If there's nothing to see here, why is the chairman of the Office for Budget Responsibility written to a committee of MPs to, in his words, set out the facts? If the facts are all absolutely plain for everybody to see, it's slightly odd that a man's chosen to write a letter to members of Parliament saying, can I set out the facts?
Well, he's responded to a request from the chair of the Treasury Select Committee in Parliament to answer their questions. The Office of Budget Responsibility is held to account by Parliament and specifically by the Treasury Select Committee. So it's perfectly normal that you answer questions put to you by Parliament. That doesn't mean...
Forgive me, that's not quite a correct characterisation, Mr. Jones. He says he's setting out the facts.
In response to questions from the Treasury Select Committee.
Are not setting out the facts.
No. I mean, you'd have to ask him about his letter, but...
MPs are going to ask him tomorrow, so we'll know.
Well, exactly why this correspondence was exchanged. We've got to be clear about the facts here, Nick. The chair of the Treasury Select Committee asked the Office for Budget Responsibility to answer their questions. He has responded to their questions. That is a good and normal process for Parliament to hold organisations like the OBR to account.
Look, this wouldn't matter, and frankly, it'd be very complicated for people to understand if it didn't have a real-world consequence. But it does. Listen, if you would, because you would have been busy doing other interviews, to this from the former Sainsbury's boss, Justin King, who spoke to us earlier on the programme.
This whole debate has had real-world consequences. The choosing of the budget date when it was, the very long run into that during a key trading period for hospitality and retail in this country, the briefing week after week after week, and yes, I would agree, the misleading position that the Chancellor took a few weeks before the budget in a speech that she didn't need to make. All of that has real-world consequences.
Real-world consequences, said a man who used to run one of our biggest supermarkets.
Sure, budgets are important in the running of our economy. You'll remember we used to have two a year under the last government, and that injected huge amounts of instability whilst decisions were taken.
I'm so sorry, Mr. Jones. He didn't say budgets matter. He said that the misrepresentation, which he called misleading, in a speech by the Chancellor given ahead of the budget, it had real-world consequences.
So look, the Chancellor set the context in which she was taking budget decisions in advance of the budget. You know, she's permitted to do that.
She only told us half the story. She told us the bad news. She didn't tell us that she'd also got good news, which actually wiped out the problem.
No, that's not correct, Nick. The OBR did downgrade its assumptions about how well the economy is performing in the future based on looking back at its performance over the last 10 years. That was a £16 billion reduction that's true and factually relevant.
Yes, I'm not disputing that. That is true. But she told us that bit. The bit I'm saying, the bit that Justin King is referring to, the bit that there may be an inquiry by the Financial Conduct Authority if the Conservatives get their way, she didn't say the other half of the story, which is that money was made up by a much higher tax take than expected. So, and forgive me for repeating myself, there was no black hole in the public finances.
There was absolutely a funding shortfall. There is no question of that, because £4 billion of headroom would not be sufficient. But I just say to you, Nick, look, people were making claims that there was too much speculation in the run-up to the budget. The Chancellor set the context in which those budget decisions are being taken to give people that insight. It was right, of course, for her not to confirm budget measures in advance of the budget, which she then did a matter of weeks afterwards at the budget last week. And this is a budget that met the needs of the public. It tackled cost of living in the short term, protected investment in the NHS, and got debt falling as a share of the economy. And in the difficult context that she set out in her speech, with that downgrade from the Office of Budget Responsibility, she has stacked up a budget that meets our fiscal rules, builds sufficient headroom, protects public services, and supports people, whilst we know the cost of living is still a challenge for too many families.
You've set out the policy choices there and why you think it's a good thing. Paul Johnson, as you know, a respected authority on these things, he used to be director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies, is now a senior advisor at Frontier Economics, says, "The speech made by the Chancellor in Downing Street before the budget was, and I quote, designed to tell a story that poor economic performance was behind the need to increase taxes. Whereas, Mr. Johnson says, what was actually behind the need to increase taxes was policy decisions. You wanted to blame economic forecasts. You wanted to blame the last government. You wanted to blame anybody other than the Labour Party who took an active decision to spend more and tax more."
Look, I don't think anyone is disputing the fact that the OBR said that the economy is not performing as well as it should be based on its review of the last 10 years. That's the context the Chancellor set out in her speech. And I say again, if the Chancellor had decided, hey, presto, we've got £4 billion of headroom in 2030, I don't need to do anything else at this budget, you would rightly be very critical, as would Paul Johnson and others, because that headroom would have been minuscule. It would have been the lowest headroom that the government has ever had in a budget process. It's right that the Chancellor increased headroom from £10 billion to £20 billion, given the number of shocks that are happening around the world.
And I don't want to weary you and our listeners. By me asking you one thing and you answering subtly a slightly different question, let me ask you to reflect more, if you would, on what Justin King told us. We've got some numbers we can put on this, haven't we? Retail sales volumes are estimated to have fallen by more than 1% in October, following an increase before that. This is the first monthly fall since May. People stopped spending. They stopped investing because the Chancellor spun the news to look as bad as possible, to try and blame someone else for the fact that you and Labour politicians had decided to put up our taxes, even though you run for office saying you wouldn't do that.
So I don't accept the premise of the question that the budget process is the reason that we have poor performance in the economy. We recognise the economy is not as strong as it needs to be, although growth has been ahead of the forecast last year at 1.5%. But we know we need to go further and faster on the economy so that people feel better off at the end of this parliament than they did at the start. That is the whole point of the Prime Minister's speech today, as we build off the back of the budget last week, to make sure that we can get Britain building again, that we tackle problems in the welfare system to help people get back into work, to build on the trade deals that we've negotiated with the European Union as well as other countries around the world, because people at home know that with the best will in the world, you can't turn around 14 years of failure, from the banking crisis through to Brexit through to COVID, in 18 months. And we've got to put the hard yards in over the course of this parliament whilst taking short-term measures to support people with the cost of living now. That's exactly what the budget did and exactly what the Prime Minister will be talking about today.
People at home, as you say, and elsewhere listening to the programme, will make their judgment having heard the arguments well aired there. Briefly, if you would, because you've just mentioned the Prime Minister's speech, we're getting rhetoric about welfare reform. We're getting mention of a review here and an investigation there. When will we actually see any welfare reform to cut the bill?
Well, you saw some in the budget last week. An example is...
The bill went up £16 billion. Mr. Jones, that was the headline on welfare in the budget.
Hang on a second. I mean, we took the decision to tackle child poverty, for which we're very proud.
When will you cut the welfare bill?
But we've already cut welfare spending where it has grown excessively. For example, on the right for people to claim luxury vehicles through the Motability Scheme, which we've changed.
Will you cut the welfare bill?
Well, we're already cutting parts of the welfare bill that need to be reduced.
When will you cut the overall welfare bill, which increased by £16 billion in the Chancellor's budget?
I'm not going to put a specific number and a specific date to the question. We have reviews being undertaken at the moment by some of my ministerial and other colleagues. But we are right to increase investment to tackle child poverty, not least because that allows those young people to be more productive in their futures, which is good for the economy, whilst tackling areas of the welfare bill that have unsustainably grown out of control, for example, on motability and in other areas, which we'll be making further announcements on in 2026.
Final question, why should people trust the Chancellor?
I think the Chancellor set out very clearly that the test of this budget was whether it would help people with the cost of living, protect investment in the NHS and get debt falling as the size of the economy, whilst taking a stable approach to the fiscal rules and headroom. And on all of those tests, the Chancellor passed them.
Darren Jones, who is Chief Secretary to the Prime Minister. A new job, but means he's right at the centre of power. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us.
It is just gone 8:30. Carthy's back with the sport and she's got company.
I have. Very exciting company. Football headlines to start. And Chelsea were down to 10 men for much of their match against Arsenal, but they held on for a 1-1 draw. Arsenal are 5 points clear at the top of the Premier League table. And Liverpool had only their second win in 8 league games. A 2-0 victory over West Ham. And as Anna has alluded to in the studio, someone who can talk about both of those results, Joe Cole, who played for Chelsea and West Ham, amongst other clubs, and England, of course, here to talk about his autobiography, Luxury Player, which I have in my hands right now. But first, if I can just ask you about those matches. Chelsea now in third place. Pretty impressive form so far this season. Have you been impressed or content with what they're doing so far?
I've been very impressed. I was working yesterday at the Crystal Palace game and I rushed home to take my boys to Chelsea. And that is the best I've seen that. That's the first time I've looked at that group and really believed in it. Because to go down to 10 men against Arsenal and perform with a character and a personality, to stay in the game, go 1-0 up, and I think they were a better team than Arsenal. And I've backed Arsenal for the Champions League and the league this year in what I've seen. I think so. Chelsea's performance yesterday was nothing short of sensational. They were brilliant.
Yeah, there was a disappointing result at West Ham. It was also a very emotional game there after the news that Billy Bond's former captain and manager had passed away at the age of 79. He was the manager when you signed at West Ham at the age of 13. Do you have memories of
him? Yeah, I do. He was like, I know a lot of people have said a lot of things. He was a real gentleman of the game. He was very kind to me and my family. You know, obviously I was being courted by a lot of clubs, and it was Billy Bonds and Harry Redknapp and Frank Lampard Senior and who really, you know, looked after us and made me feel welcome and made me want to sign for West Ham, them three men. So, you know, really fond memories of him, and he epitomises everything that was great about West Ham, and you know, my love and prayers are to his family.
Your time at West Ham, you just mentioned briefly there, when you were very young, you had an apprenticeship that I don't think many young footballers would be able to get now. You were sweeping the floor, cleaning the changing rooms for the players, and I guess understanding a little bit about what was there before you started playing at the age of 17 professionally for West Ham. How much did that shape your early years?
Yeah, I mean, writing the book was a real prep pleasure, because you go back and you think about all these times, you know the cleaning the dressing rooms, washing boots, and then it's such an unusual thing.
Jock straps, apparently.
Yeah, it was. it wasn't pleasant, you know. It didn't. But during that time, my job was to clean the home team dressing room, and I was listening as a 16-year-old. I was listening to the way that they were talking to each other, the rhythm. And I was sweeping the floors, but taking in so much information and learning and it was brilliant to go back over old memories and all things like that. And I thoroughly think players should, maybe not quite the jock straps cleaning, but I think it didn't do me no harm.
Well, you wrote the book, I think, partly because you just wanted to process some of your life. You know, you're very proud of being from Kentish Town, didn't really play organised football until you were 11, quite a different background to, I think, some of the other players in your generation. How much did you learn from the process? And I think you were doing it with Sam Wallace, who's a great journalist as well.
Yeah, Sam's a great journalist and he really captured my voice. I mean, the whole writing of it was amazing, like, because it's an unusual thing to become a footballer. Most of us are from working class backgrounds. You know, like I said, I come from Kentish Town, which I'm really proud of. And to go through that, and all of a sudden to get stardom at 16, 17, and then that is so it's a process. And I think I retired at 36, folks, and I don't think there's any footballer that retires out the game and it's an easy transition, because it's such an unusual thing. You get given the keys to the door and, you know, adulation, the fame and just playing and being part of something, and then you stop. So I had a few years retired and I thought about doing it, and then it wasn't until I was writing it you realise, you know, how difficult that transition to retiring was and everything, because all of a sudden you're not a young footballer, you're a 44-year-old man with 3 children, a different job, and it just looking back and it was just great. I had such a good time with Sam writing the book, and I think he's captured me.
Yeah, book is very funny. There are things like you mention strapping your children into the car like they're astronauts when you used to roll around the back of the van.
I know.
With no seatbelts on.
Again, and my kids live. We live in Chelsea, and my kids live a very different life to me. And I love them and proud of them. But you look back and we're market traders by, and I was back of the big market van. Being thrown around, no seatbelts. I know that doesn't sound good for my mum and dad just at the moment, but it was a different time, the 90s. And I think Sam captures that as well, because also living in Kentish Town in the 90s in Camden, it felt like you was at the centre of the world. Like it was such a cool sort of up-and-coming place. You had MTV was moving in there, and there was all the bands and everything in it. And then you had the rough part of it as well. So it was a brilliant place to grow up. I had such fun growing up.
And you just say in the book, it nags away at you that you want to be a manager. Who and where and when?
Well, good question. I mean, it's great to see a few of my old friends like Scott Park and Frank Lampard doing well. I was going to retire, and I'd done my coaching badges and I went straight into the Chelsea Academy, and that would have been my path. But the media sort of just took over. And with the job that I do now with the media, I get to spend a lot of time with my kids, which is fantastic. I get to go and watch them play football, netball, cricket, and just be with them. But I'm a football person at heart, you know, and I look and I want that challenge at some point. And I know I'll probably do it in an unusual fashion.
Interesting.
Yeah. But I've got my ideas and my beliefs on how football should be played. And I'd love to do it at one point. And I don't know when. I really don't.
It sounds like there's a lot more to this conversation than we have time for, unfortunately. Exactly, yes. Well, Joe Cole, luxury player, it is very funny, as I said. I really enjoyed reading.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming into the studio.
The alternative, presumably, is you could set yourself up as a market trader so that your kids have some feeling for what you...
I was actually a market... I was a Saturday boy in Camden, and I was brilliant at it. Unbelievable. I sold all the melons in 1 week, and my dad gave me £10 for doing it.
So, oh, well done.
Yeah, it was good. Yeah, I used to absolutely love it, honestly.
Yeah, your kids do.
Yeah.
Treat, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, trailing ahead to a book there, let's trail ahead to something you can get even quicker. And it's free. Start the week on Radio 4 at 9 o'clock. Here's Tom with news of that.
Morning, Nick. We're going from the unimaginably large to the unimaginably small this week, from all the way to the edge of the observable universe, 13.5 billion light years away, to the microscopic realm where classical physics stops working and quantum mechanics takes over. With us, the space scientist Maggie Aderin-Pocock, Caroline Smith, curator of meteorites at the Natural History Museum, and the physicist Paul Davis, whose latest book explores a theory that he candidly admits makes no sense, but is demonstrably true anyway. All of them are stars in their fields. Two of them are asteroids as well. You can find out how on Start of the Week, just after 9.
I will. That's well up my street. Thank you, Tom. The weather today, wet, windy. It should turn drier, apparently, for a time in the north, but there will be heavy rain in Wales and the west of England.
It is coming up to 21 minutes to 9. You're listening on to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson. And here's Jane Steele with a summary of the news.
Two former heads of UK special forces have been accused of covering up evidence of war crimes in Afghanistan. A senior officer who can't be named has told a public inquiry that the leadership knew there was a problem but did nothing. A court in Bangladesh has found the Labour MP Tulip Siddiq guilty of corruption charges and sentenced her to 2 years in jail. She was convicted of using her influence over her aunt, who is the ousted Bangladeshi Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina, to secure a plot of land for her family. Ms. Siddiq denies the charges, saying they are politically motivated. Sir Keir Starmer will defend the budget in a speech later and set out a pledge to reform welfare. The Prime Minister is also expected to back his Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, who denies misleading the public about the state of the UK's finances. The Chief Secretary to the Prime Minister, Darren Jones, told this programme there was no question there was a funding shortfall and it was right that the Chancellor increased her fiscal headroom. Rage bait has been named as Oxford University Press's Word of the Year. The phrase refers to online content that prompts people to click on it out of anger.
Jane, thank you very much indeed. It's 20 to 9 now. The fall of the Sudanese city of El Fasher was one of the most horrific events in the country's civil war. The city was surrounded by the RSF, the Rapid Support Forces, for 18 months before they finally broke the siege just over a month ago, expelling the army from its last stronghold in the western region of Darfur. It was a huge victory for the paramilitary group, but widespread accounts of brutality, killing and rape have drawn international condemnation. Our Africa correspondent Barbara Platt-Usher has been speaking to some of those who fled, and she now joins us from Port Sudan. Morning, Barbara.
Good morning. Yes, that fall of El Fasher was a very significant chapter in the country's civil war. As you said, the RSF finally expelled the army from its last foothold in the vast western region of Darfur. But it wasn't victory for the RSF that the world took notice of. They took notice of these widespread accounts of atrocities, killing of civilians, rape, beatings, that sort of thing, that just drew a lot of international attention and condemnation. And we were covering this, reporting on this from Nairobi, using material interviews gathered by local freelancers. But now we have traveled ourselves to a camp near the town of Aldaba in northern Sudan to hear the stories of those who escaped. The camp is about 500 miles from El Fasher, so quite a long trek for the people who got there. It's an army-controlled territory, so we were monitored in the camp. And there is a warning, listeners might find some of these details distressing. We're in the desert on the outskirts of the town of Aldaba, row after row of tents set up in the sand, and it's very hot. People try to squeeze into the bits of shade offered by the tents where they can. The children are running around and playing. Right at the edge of the camp is a place where the newest arrivals have gathered, waiting to be assigned tents. And we've been speaking to some of them about their experiences. Mohammed Abakar Ahmed Adam is sitting on the ground with his family. He was a local official in a camp for displaced people next to El Fasher, who fled to the city as the RSF advanced, then fled again when the paramilitaries captured it. The road here was full of death, he says.
They shot some people directly in front of us. Then they carried them and threw them far away. And on the road, we saw dead bodies out in the open, unburied. Some had lain there for 2 or 3 days.
RSF fighters also raped women, he said, corroborating widespread accounts of sexual violence.
They would take a woman behind a tree or take her far from us, out of sight, so you wouldn't see with your own eyes. But you would hear her shout, "Help me, help me." And she would come and say, "They raped me."
There are mostly women here. Many don't want to be identified to protect those left behind. One 19-year-old woman told us the RSF took a girl from the group she was traveling with, and they had to leave her behind. I was scared, she says. When they took her out of the car at the checkpoint, I was afraid that at every checkpoint they would take a girl. But they just took her, and that was it until we got here. She'd traveled with her younger sister and brother. Her mother was not in El Fasher when it fell, so they escaped the city on foot with their grandmother. But she died before they reached the first stop, leaving them to carry on alone. My grandmother passed out, and I thought it might be from lack of food or water, she says. I checked her pulse, but she didn't wake up. So I found a doctor in a nearby village. He came, and he said, "Your grandmother has given you her soul." I didn't know how I would tell my mother. It was the 15-year-old brother they were all worried about, because the RSF suspected that fleeing men had fought with the army.
They took the young men out of the cars and interrogated us for hours in the hot sun. They said we were soldiers. Some of the older ones probably were. The RSF fighters stood over us and circled around us, whipping us and threatening us with their guns. I lost hope and told them, whatever you want to do to me, do it. But finally, they let me go.
He and his two sisters journeyed hundreds of miles through the desert to get here, a camp in army-held territory. We found Abdul Qadir wandering around the camp, a 62-year-old man trying to get his family registered for a tent. He was crippled during the long siege of Al-Fashr because he couldn't find medicine for his diabetes. But he was so panicked by the RSF, he didn't feel the pain as he ran.
They were shooting at the people, the elderly, the civilians with live ammunition. They would empty their guns on them. Some of the RSF came with their cars. If they saw someone was still breathing, they drove over them. At the checkpoint when they separated the men from the women, boom, 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 they shot them. They shot the men.
The RSF told the BBC it's investigating individual violations, but it denies systematic abuse of civilians. Both sides are accused of war crimes. People in the camp have been broken again and again, but they are resilient. This particularly brutal chapter in Sudan's civil war has focused greater international attention on trying to end the conflict. But for those here, any hope they have is grounded in their faith. Allahu Akbar, Allahu
Akbar, Allahu Akbar. That is Barbara Pletusher reporting from Port Sudan. It is 14 minutes to nine now. There's a new podcast launching on BBC Sounds Day that you might enjoy. It is a new series of The Bomb from the BBC World Service that's delved really deeply over the last two series into how the nuclear bomb shaped the world. And this time, it's the story of the Cuban Missile Crisis, but told by the relatives of the leaders who were negotiating that tricky landscape at the time. In October of 1962, the then US President John F. Kennedy made a televised address about the crisis beginning.
We will not prematurely or unnecessarily risk the course of worldwide nuclear war, in which even the fruits of victory would be ashes in our mouth. But neither will we shrink from that risk at any time it must be faced.
Well, I've been speaking to the hosts of the series, JFK's nephew, Max Kennedy, and Nina Khrushcheva, the great-granddaughter of the former Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev, about how they came to learn, well, of that story, but also about their family links to it when they were growing up.
I learned in bits and pieces because Nikita Khrushchev was ousted from power in 1964. And when I was growing up, they really didn't talk about politics that much. But you did know about the Cuban Missile Crisis, about mistakes that Khrushchev made because he withdrew weapons from Cuba and he gave in to American imperialism. And that's how we learn about it at school. And so at home, I was told that it was a great thing because, as Khrushchev himself used to say, what do you want me to do to back off what you wanted me to start World War III? So I was in this very dual relationship with history. On one hand, it was a family story, was a good decision for him to make. And at school, in history lessons, I learned that, no, it was a very wrong thing to do because you never give in to imperialism.
That's really interesting, that contrast between the two narratives that you were hearing. What about you, Max?
Similar to Nina in that it came in bits and pieces because I was, you know, so young. And the first time I really spent any time thinking about it was when they filmed a television program called The Missiles of October. And I just remember sort of sitting around with my mother and older siblings, and they gave a running commentary of how inaccurate every scene was that had my father or my uncle in it. But I think that the central issue for me growing up was that we didn't really understand how incredibly close the two countries really came to nuclear war and to the kind of war that would have annihilated the world, because we didn't understand until this, you know, very late meeting in around 1988 that Khrushchev had succeeded in putting, you know, shorter range tactical nuclear weapons in Cuba. And at the very beginning of the crisis, almost everyone in the White House wanted to bomb the missile sites and to attack Cuba with our naval forces. Had we done that, the United States Sixth Fleet would have been completely annihilated with just a few nuclear weapons. And if that had happened, we would have launched a full-scale attack on Russia and the world would have been obliterated. So that lesson, that very tight lesson to, you know, just exercise a great deal of care with national policy was the thing that really hit home most to me.
And given, Nina, how close the world came to that actually happening, how much do you think the relationship between these two men related to you and Max, how important do you think that was in eventually neutralizing that threat?
It's a fascinating question, because I always thought, when I learned more and more about it and spoke more about it, read books about it, I thought it was really very close and something that Max said, if decisions were, there was a split second decisions, if just 1 millimeter away, 1 inch away from a decision would have been a different one, and then the world could have come very close to be blown up completely. But the more I've learned in this program, I realized that actually we weren't that close. And the reason we weren't that close, because of these two leaders that made those decisions, because either of them, absolutely, it seemed to me, at no circumstances were ready to start the war. Say they were ready to do everything not to have the war. And so I actually got out of finishing this program and immersing in it with a feeling that I wish our leaders today would have been as responsible as JFK, John F. Kennedy, and Nikita Khrushchev were in 1962.
Well, I had the same conclusion, that I wish that today's leaders were more similar to President Kennedy and to Chairman Khrushchev. But I had a very different reaction to the threat. I think we were very, very close to nuclear war during many days of those 13 days. And that the scariest part to me was that you could tell that Chairman Khrushchev wanted to do everything to avoid war, and that President Kennedy wanted to do everything to avoid war. And they were both determined to explore every avenue to peace before going to war. But there is an inexorable nature of conflict that was bringing them closer and closer. The armed forces, the military-industrial complex, were all moving us closer and closer to doom. And that was very scary to me.
You both talk there about the difference between leaders that we see today. And there are so many conflicts going on and so many personalities at play that sometimes move parties closer and sometimes push them further away. What lessons, Nina, do you think that modern leaders could learn from the way that things were conducted then?
Well, they can learn a lot of lessons. That is, they can learn a lesson of negotiation. They can learn a lesson to listen to your opponent. They can learn a lesson to find every avenue, as Max said, every avenue available to find a way not to have a conflict. But we are not seeing that. So these are lessons, unfortunately, not learned. And I think one of the reasons that it is repeated many times, but it's very important to stress, that these two leaders went through war, World War II, and they knew what destruction it can bring, and they did everything in their power not to repeat it. Unfortunately, we don't have such responsible leaders today, because people seem to be incredibly cavalier about potential of war, about war itself, about even nuclear threats that they keep throwing around almost every day.
Do you agree with that, Max, that today's leaders are not as responsible?
Well, look, it doesn't take a great psychiatrist to see that the leaders, that President Trump is driven by ego more than anything else. And that was completely absent from President Kennedy and Chairman Khrushchev, who I think had different views of what was best for their countries, but really did want what was best for their nations. And if you have a leader that's driven by ego, it's a very, very dangerous thing. And we see that day in and day out with both Putin and Donald Trump.
That is Max Kennedy and Nina Khrushcheva, who host that podcast. And you can find episode one of The Bomb, Kennedy and Khrushchev. It's available. Well, in fact, it's available on BBC Sounds now, because I've just checked for you and it's there and waiting. And you can also find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts from. It is 6 minutes to nine. Just to say, by the way, you might have heard of An American in Paris. Over on Radio 3 Breakfast shortly, Tom McKinney is about to play A Russian in Italy. Tchaikovsky's joyous response to A Holiday in Sun-Drenched Rome, which sounds rather nice this morning, doesn't it? 1st of December, it's raining.
Oh, we can dream. It's 5 to 9. Now, those of us of a certain age can remember a rather big moment in the newspaper industry. The moment a new paper was born, called The Independent. Only possible, really, because of the fight that Rupert Murdoch had had with the unions in the print industry, but it said it would do something very different. It would, as the name suggested, be independent. It would not represent a political cause. It would not fight for a political party or for leaders with whom its owners had good relationships. And at the centre of that was the co-founder of The Independent, a man called Sir Andreas Whittam Smith, who's died at the age of 88. A man inspired by him, though I suspect wasn't even alive at the time, joins us now. You may have heard of him. Amol Rajan's his name. He went on to be editor in the Independent. And he joins on the line. Morning.
Nick, that was such a masterful introduction, except for once. I hate
it. Is it all untrue, is it?
I was 3 years old on the 7th of October,
well,
1986. I'd arrived in India 4 weeks earlier when that great paper was founded. Yes, but what a moment it was. And you're absolutely right to mention the debt to Rupert Murdoch.
Yeah, and I should begin by asking your memories, age 3. No, I won't do that. Just capture a sense, though, as you grew up and knew about this paper, what was the achievement of this man who inspired you, Andreas Whittam Smith?
Well, it was the first paper, the quality title, launched in Britain, I think, for about 131 years. And it's very, very hard for some of our, frankly, younger listeners, people maybe under 40, to really grasp the incredible power of newspapers in post-war Britain. And I think, if you want to understand post-war Britain, you've got to understand modern Fleet Street. And if you want to understand modern Fleet Street, you've got to understand Andreas Whittam Smith, who's died this weekend, and the founding of The Independent in October 1986. It really was this embodiment, not of Thatcher's politics, but I think of Thatcher's Britain, because Andreas and his co-founders, Stephen Glover and Matthew Symonds, they were these Telegraph journalists, and they did something pretty radical and pioneering. They said, we're going to launch a new newspaper, we're going to hire an incredible team. And do you know what? They pulled it off. I mean, they had the most amazing team. The first byline was Sarah Hogg, who went on to be very influential in British politics. The byline underneath her was some guy called Andrew Marr. There was a byline of the paper. Yeah, Mark Urban. So they pulled off something quite extraordinary. And with it, they changed Fleet Street forever.
But they provided something that many readers wanted, captured in that famous ad slogan, "It is our you."
Yes, I think there was a genuine, and this is what Andreas was always very keen to impress upon me when, with much lower circulation, sadly, The Independent was under my stewardship nearly 30 years later. There was always a genuine spirit of The Independent. It was radical. It was pioneering. It was of no party or faction. It generally avoided stories about royals on the grounds that they weren't really news. It took big pictures very seriously. And it had this spirit of innovation, which various editors, much more successful than me, tried to carry on. So in 2003, many of our listeners will remember that the great visionary editor Simon Kellner made The Independent go from being broadsheet sized to being compact, and The Times then followed. The Independent was led the charge against the Iraq war. It took climate change very seriously. In 2010, it launched a newspaper called The Eye, which everyone said you're mad to do, but it's today very successful and part of the Daily Mail group. And then in 2016, it went fully digital. So there was a spirit of trying to innovate. It's just that in the end, you couldn't innovate so hard with newspapers that you kept the newspaper going. But he was very keen on that spirit. And at the heart of all of it, Nick, as you say, was this very unlikely figure, Andreas, tall, ethereal. He hated being compared to a bishop, but he was a man of God, and he did have this kind of slightly otherworldly presence. And yet, together with Glover and Symonds in the 1980s, he did something genuinely extraordinary.
And believed in the value of journalism, too creative is not too pompous a way of putting it, in a better world.
Absolutely. He was very, very high-minded, and he was very conscious as well of the debt he owed people like Rupert Murdoch, who championed journalism. I mean, Murdoch basically took on the print unions in the mid-80s that created the conditions in which The Independent could survive and thrive. The Independent briefly overtook The Times in circulation, but then Murdoch launched a price war against it in the 1990s, and that was the beginning of a very long end. But he was high-minded about journalism in a way I think people who listen to